Welcome back, Place to Be Nation. I'm Tyler Kelly, and I'm here with my buddy Jacob Williams. And much like Brian Danielson and Job, a.k.a. Gob Bluth, we are on the final countdown in our case for the countdown to our greatest WCW match ever. How are you doing, Jake?
I'm good. I can't believe we made it this far. It's been quite a journey. It almost felt like doing the list all over again because I rewatched everything for this. So it's been quite a, you know, I think when we started, we're kind of like, yeah, we'll go through our list or whatever. And then throughout it, it's turned into quite a little project going back through it and rewatching the matches, discussing it. But it's been a lot of fun. But it's cool to finally be in here. We have the cream of the crop, as Macho Man would say.
Yeah, I agree. I wasn't really thinking of watching everything, but I have as well. So, and when you consider that there were matches that were on my list that might not have been on yours, and vice versa, you know, that's quite a few matches there. In fact, I do have that we had 63 of the same, so that's the 37. So we probably each watched 137 matches, I guess. So, yeah, that was a little bit of an undertaking, and I'm not to be confused with the Undertaker, who does not appear on any of our lists. So,
no.
But it does feel
me
like
Mark Callis. Me, Mark Callis, unfortunately, did not make the cut.
He did not. But maybe we should get to talking about what did make the cut. As you mentioned, Jake, we are in the creme de la creme, the very tippy top matches, and it is your turn to start us off your number 10 match.
Yes, so my number 10 would be a classic pairing, which I think the majority of what we're going to talk about till the end of both of our lists, at least when it comes to singles matches, are going to be made of a lot of classic pairings. And this is one we've talked about before with the Starrcade match, but I actually had this one a tad higher. This would be Flair and Luger at WrestleWar 1990. And so I do have these, just to say, because I think what it comes down to, I feel like this might be a little bit of a, I wouldn't say controversial, because I think both matches are pretty beloved, but I do think it's more, I would say that the Starrcade 88 match is probably is a little bit more well-regarded, but I do like this one a bit more. I had the Starrcade match pretty high, too. I forget exactly where. It was definitely my top 30, I want to say, but this one, for whatever reason, I like it more. So in rewatching it this time, I was trying to articulate and figure out, okay, when I rewatched it for this spot, like what is it that makes it stand out to me? Why do I like this one a touch more than the other one? And so one thing is that I think in all their matches, Lex has great intensity, but I just feel like it's a little bit higher up in this one. I don't know, because he's possibly a little bit more established by this point. You could really feel maybe going into the 90s. I mean, we kind of know where they end up going, but you could maybe have in your head that maybe they're going to, like, Lex is going to be their guy, possibly. Now, that's part of this match, too. But anyway, I feel like his intensity is a little bit stepped up compared to Starrcade. And I feel like this whole match, and it's something, as we get into his last feud, that I think separated some of these matches from ones that were similar for me, is that I tended to go, and maybe it's just my taste, but ones that I felt had that kind of intensity over maybe the technical, prowess, I guess you could say. And I feel like this one is maybe not as technically sound as a Starrcade match, but I like the intensity of it. It feels a little bit more, I think, heated than the other one. And it's just like in the Starrcade match, Flair just makes him look so great. Lex, I mean, Lex has played his part great, but man, just everything he does, he's either like selling Luger's moves and like begging off and making Luger look like a monster, or whenever he's on offense, he's just so good at using his dirty tactics to get sympathy for Luger, which I think is really masterful, because I think Luger as a babyface might be a guy who's hard to get sympathy for, because he is such a powerhouse and he almost seems like too dominant to really get sympathy. But Flair's so good at it because he uses these kind of underhanded tactics to get the to get the crowd behind him. So he simultaneously is getting sympathy, but then also looks like this unstoppable like powerhouse, which makes for a really awesome match. Again, we talked about this with the Starrcade match, but this has everything that match has and just a touch more for me. Like, I love, there's great moments in here where Luger, like, I love the parts in this where, because Flair does get a decent amount of offense in here. I mean, there's a, you know, it's a lot of Lex beating his ass a lot, but man, when he really gets up on him, like, I love whenever he's kind of working over Luger, and you could just see Luger get like a little bit frustrated. He just fires up on him and just becomes like invincible for a second and just goes straight at him. And you could see the crowd is totally with him, and the crowd fires up too. Just those moments in this match are awesome. I really like the dynamic in this one too, that about halfway, it's a pretty long match. I want to say this one goes near 40 minutes when it's all said and done. So it's a pretty long match. It never loses you. I'm hooked the entire match. I love that Luger goes for like the holds and stuff about halfway through, because he's going in with this typical kind of, power offense. And it's almost like halfway through the match, he realizes, because they have met each other before and kind of know each other, he has to change it up. And they do a good job of, and as always, Flair sells it. Amazing that he's kind of caught off guard when Luger starts, like Luger does the sleeper hold. He starts going for more like, I guess, mat based stuff rather than just sticking to all the power. So it kind of changes it up in the second half of the match, and Flair has to adapt to it. And then, I feel like maybe some would not like this ending, but I think the ending here in the storytelling, I think, adds a little bit that you don't get in the Starrcade match too. And that the twist is that pretty much that Luger has the match won. JR's call here is amazing too. When he has Flair in the rack, you just hear JR go, "Flair is a beaten man. He is a beaten man." But then, so of course Sting has the torn knee. And so he's on the outside trying to support Luger, which is a cool dynamic. I think it works better than you would think. But, so the Horsemen come out, and as he has Flair in the torture rack, the Horsemen are about to pretty much destroy Sting because he's injured. He can't fight back. And so Luger, there's this great, and he plays it well. His facials are great. You could see the moment when he decides, but he's basically choosing that moment. He can either win the title or he can save his friend Sting. And I thought it was a cool moment to have him sort of sacrifice the title shot to save Sting, because it's kind of like Sting was the reason he was in the match in the first place, because if Sting wouldn't be injured, it would probably be Sting in the match. So I thought that was a really cool thing. You know, some people would maybe find it hokey, but I think it's a cool character moment for Luger as a face. If you're trying to build him as a face, I thought that was a cool moment. So I actually kind of like that finish. I think it makes for a really dramatic call, because the fans are kind of with him, because they don't know what to think either, because they want him to win the title. But, you know, Sting is so beloved, they don't want to see Sting, you know, get his career ended by the Horsemen on the outside. So I love all that drama. I think it adds a little bit of an extra touch to the match. I like the extra intensity. But by all means, they're both of them, this and the Starrcade match, are both excellent. I think it's probably not a hot take to say that Flair is Luger's, like quite a few guys, probably Flair is his best opponent, and they just have such excellent chemistry. And this is a fantastic match. I just love this one so much.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's probably safe to call Flair Luger's best opponent. So this match finished number 22 overall on the voter list. And I guess you are correct in that the Starrcade 88 match finished higher, but finished as match number 21. And wow. I agree with you that I like this match better. And I think that almost has to not have an asterisk, but what kind of drove the Starrcade match over it, I believe, is that it received the number one vote. So that carries quite a bit of weight. So for them to finish that close, you know, I think that they're both great. Both of them made my list. I like this one just a touch better. I had this match at 26. So it's interesting, too, when you get this high on the list, that feels like, well, you know, that was like you're a lot higher on it, but it's not, you know, 16 spots even. You wouldn't think anything was 86 and 70, you know. So it's kind of interesting how that goes. So, you know, the crowd just loved Luger on this night. Jimbo Diddley Ross, as Terry Funk called him on commentary, which I had to make note of that, because I don't know what that is, but he knows that Flair bails every time he gets a little hot in the kitchen. And I think that it stood out to me that he cheated a lot, which sounds silly because Ric Flair kind of always cheats a lot, but he did a lot of thumbs to the eyes, and he did a lot of, I had the Flair and woman also go for a lot of eye-based offense.
Yes, and retina-based offense.
There you go, yes. and I really liked Woman with Flair here. I thought that she was a good fit with this character, this iteration of Flair, kind of, and she interfered pretty liberally here. And, you know, Flair's always putting his feet on the ropes, nearly every pin attempt. And again, that's not uncommon for Flair, but I felt like he ramped that up just a little bit for this match. And Luger was working a little harder than he does. And, you know, later in his career, he kind of pitched some crap for that, and much more deservedly so. But like, there are times he's just sprinting across the ring, going for clotheslines or shoulder blocks, and just really working hard. And I talked a little bit before about how sometimes Luger will kind of no-sell, as it's like a hope spot for him. And he did that here when he's selling the chop, no-selling the chops, which makes sense because he's so muscular. And I'm with you. I like the finish. I like Sting comes out. And I thought it was a nice moment when he just screams at Luger to kick his you-know-what, and then he slaps him. But it's, you know, that motivational slap. So as opposed to like a disrespectful slap. So, but for those listening at home, do not try this at work. If you have, if you're a supervisor, a motivation, you cannot slap an employee and have it be considered motivational. So allegedly. So I'm told anyway. But yeah, then when Luger does make that choice to save Sting, I had that really gets Lex over as a babyface, but it's a little late because they were just kind of keeping the title warm for Sting. So, and that's kind of one criticism. I don't know if it's even so much of the match, but it's just that it feels like Luger should have won. And obviously the timing of that was just awful for that to have happened. It feels like Luger should have won in Starrcade and here, and that's part of how he got kind of that choker label, as silly as that is for pro wrestling. But I wonder, as hot as Luger was as a heel in 89, if they just never turned him and had him be Sting's big first rivalry. I mean, I think they could have done some great things with the heel run that Luger was on, but of course you would lose this match and the Capital Combat match and just kind of that Flair Luger rivalry there in early 90s. So I'm not sure that would be worth it, but it was just a thought I had.
Yeah. And it's I'll mention it real quick before we move on to your number nine, but it's something I noticed as we're getting into our top tens is that WrestleWar, kind of a low key pay-per-view for having, you know, I don't think it's the most marquee. It only was around for a few years, but man, it really, it made the most of its time because there's quite a few matches in both of our top tens for a pay-per-view that only had a few shows.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I had one at 11 that just missed my top 10. And that was the War Games from 1991.
So. Yeah, obviously the War Games connection helps it becoming a War Games show for its existence. Definitely helped it. But it is funny just to think, you know, WrestleWar just kind of, you know, it's not one of those marquee shows like a Starrcade or a Havoc or something like that.
Yeah. Well, it picked two good War Games to go to. But. And speaking of that, we are not on any War Games matches next. My number 10 is a tag team match, and it's the highest tag team match that I had on my list. And that is the Midnight Express versus the Southern Boys from Great American Bash 1990. This finished as match number 18 on the voter list, and it did finish as the highest tag match on the voter list as well. It's for the U.S. tag titles, and it starts with a brawl, and the Southern Boys get really good shine and stand tall. And I just have that this is such a random great match, as Ross even notes that Southern Boys have won several regional titles, which is not particularly impressive, especially hearing it today. So, and I think they had a few good TV matches, but you know, the fact that they can have a match this good and they really did very little else is kind of an indictment on WCW in some ways. So this was their first pay-per-view, and they're, like I said, they're getting good shine. Smothers hits a savate kick on Eaton. That is prompting Stan to get in the ring for a karate showdown, and that's semi-famous, you know, exchange for this match. It's kind of known for that karate exchange. Stan gets his licks in before Smothers wins that battle, and the crowd just loves it. And Cornette's just hamming it up, as he often does. I think Smothers in particular is a really good wrestler, and she shows fire very well. I think that's one of his strengths, is kind of firing up. Midnight give the Southern Boys a kind of a really long shine, probably because they're not as well known, and we've seen them do that in other matches. Like when the Fantastics were just debuting, they did that a lot as well. So they know how to get the faces over. Lane sucker punches Smothers to turn the tide, but only for a minute, as Armstrong comes off the top for a crossbody, as the Southern Boys go for a couple double team pins, and the crowd's just eating it up. Everything's really crisp and well executed from both teams. JR and Cottle are comparing the Southern Boys to street players in basketball. They get hot, so far the story.
They don't look like they would be the biggest fans of basketball based on, you know,
yeah,
their presentation.
Correct. I think, yeah, comparing them to, like, if you're those New York street ballers, that's probably a little off. But I do like the comparison to real sports, that, you know, sometimes it's about matchups and they kind of have their number, or they got hot at the right time. I like that part of the story, because I think that gets them over a little. But I think that makes it seem like they have a better chance than maybe they really do. But yeah, point well taken that Tracy and Armstrong probably are not going to be going and playing street ball anytime soon. The Midnights get a blind tag and throw Tracy over the top, and Stan's immediately over there to work him over outside. So that's how they take over. And then Cornette adds a racket shot. And like we talked about before, the Midnights just pounce anytime there's a, you know, anytime they get the advantage. There's an atomic drop into a Bobby, then hits a backbreaker. And just, you know, the very smooth double teams that the Midnights are known for. They're working Smothers back, including their leapfrog splash. And then Bobby hits the Alabama Jam, but it's not the finish. So I don't know if that disproves my theory, but nothing else was. So I think it's still kind of a work in progress, I guess. But that wasn't the finish. The bump to the ass jarred him so bad that he had to tag out. So Stan gets in, and he appears to be doing the chicken dance before doing a punch, which, if you've watched many Midnight matches, as I know you have, and anybody that did this project did, you probably know exactly what I'm talking about. He's flapping his arms, and I'm doing it now, and looks like a bit of a moron. But, you know, he does it regularly. So the Midnights do a sweet double-team kick, and then Bobby hits a neck breaker. Smothers is doing a really good job at the face and peril, and sprinkling in a few hope spots, which, you know, that's always kind of the mark of a fiery babyface I look for. Don't just take a shit kick. Make sure you get the hope spots in, you know, well timed. So it's a nice double team sunset flip. But instead of going for the pin, he actually makes a hot tag to Armstrong, which I really like. So I like the baby face team, you know, kind of using their brains a little bit, you know. So Armstrong comes in, and he's a house of fire of punches, chops, and a flying shoulder block. And the Southern Boys hit their finisher, which is like a doomsday drop kick. I'm sure it had a name, but the ref was late on the count. And then the Midnight Express hit a rocket launcher, but the ref's trying to get everybody out and it's a little slow. And Armstrong gets his shoulder up in a super hot near fall there. The Southern Boys do the switcheroo and they play possum for another great near fall. And here's where I haven't damned this match rules. So, and that's another one where baby faces look smart, like they're kind of giving the heels a little bit of a taste of their own medicine. So you're starting to kind of wonder if maybe they could pull this off. And then rather abruptly, Stan hits a savate kick to Smothers as he runs the ropes, and Eaton cradles for the win. So I think it's still just tremendous execution of the Southern Tag formula. A lot of cool offense from both sides, good selling. It's a great job to immediately get the Southern Boys over so that WCW could proceed to do absolutely nothing with them, as they do. But, and I thought it was an especially strong performance from Smothers. So,
Yeah, this is kind of one of those. I feel like this is a popular one. I don't know if you know offhand where this finished. Do you know where this finished on the main list, the composite list, if you will?
Yes, mm-hmm. Number 18.
Yeah, I thought so. I guess that, I think I have this one a little low. I don't know if I'll go as high as like in the top 20, but I know this is a very beloved match. And I think one of the coolest parts of this is that, like, if you're just watching this stuff, if you're somebody like me who was, you know, I was not old enough to be cognizant of anything in 1990. Well, actually, I was born. This is actually a month before I was born. No, look at the date. But anyway, if you weren't born like me, and so you're just going back and watching this stuff, and you don't really have a ton of context for it. It is really cool when you have this match. You see the Southern, you know, in the if you took a shot for every time JR and I think it's Cobb right on here on this one on commentary, and I feel like if you took a shot every time they called them, said the full on like those Wild Out Southern boys, like if you would be loaded because they constantly say that whole little thing, they're really trying to get it over. But if you see them, they kind of like, and I know it's like Smothers and you know, and they're you know, good wrestlers and stuff, but they have like a little bit of a goofy vibe. It seems a little bit like a goofy gimmick sort of in a way when they come out with like the rebel flags and everything. And I know it's a different time period, but and then they just come in and like they're just awesome, and they have this like insane like face energy that's just like off the wall and stuff. It's just like can kind of catch you off guard if you're not expecting it when you watch this match. And I think it's really awesome, and it really grows on you as it goes, just to see these guys that like in a way could look like they're just going to be like some whatever team, and they come in and just are super awesome and super fired up and energetic. It's really awesome. But yeah, I had 77, but I do enjoy this match. I think it's probably a little low. I think if I went back, I'd probably put it up a bit higher, because this really is an awesome match like you described.
Yes. So, speaking of awesome matches, carry on to, I believe we're up to your number 9.
Yeah, so my number 9 is one that we are actually going to talk about in just a second, because you have it a touch higher, I believe, which would be Ray and Eddie from Halloween Havoc 97. So we'll talk about that one in a second, right?
That is correct. I have that a little bit higher. So we'll move to my number 9, which I believe we will also talk about a little bit later, because you have it a little bit higher, and that is Ric Flair versus Terry Funk from the Great American Bash 1989.
Yes, we will talk about that one a bit close to the end of the show. I'll put it that way. But anyway, the next one that we're actually going to talk about will be my number 8, which is going to be Ricky Steamboat versus Rick Rude from Beach Blast 92. This is the 30-minute Iron Man match. I love this match. This is one of my favorites ever. It's kind of one of my – it's not like – I think this is one of the first ones that's funny. I think me and JT, when this first started, we kind of briefly did a few over the North-South view where we kind of live watch them. And it, the funny part is that we were live watching it, and I guess we were just talking. I didn't have enough time to really pay attention to the details of the match. I was like, oh, yeah, this is good. This will probably make my list. But I felt like I didn't watch it close enough. So I went back and watched it after and just completely fell in love with it. Like, man, it's just so good. I like that they went with the 30-minute instead of a 60-minute, because I think it avoids a lot of the, you know, the downfalls of some Iron Man matches, because like the Bret Shawn one is famous for this, that it kind of starts a little bit slow, and you can kind of tell the first, they don't want to run themselves ragged in the first 15-20 minutes, so they kind of take it slow. Where in this one, they go balls to the wall right from the beginning, which I think is a cool twist on the Iron Man. Like they don't start slow, they go right after it. I love too that Rude, even though he gets dominated pretty much throughout the first part, which is really awesome. Like Steamboat's really hammer him. There's a lot of great heat to this. Like even though an Iron Man, I think sometimes can be seen as, you know, I think by its nature, it's sort of meant to be this like athletic showcase, and this match is, but also has a lot of there's a lot of hate between these two guys. It's really awesome because by this point their feud's cooking pretty well, and so I like that aspect of it, that it is athletic, but it really is sort of a grudge match in the same way. And they kind of work both styles, which I think is really cool in this match. But I love the twist of Rude getting the first fall, despite being worked over like the first 10 minutes. But he ends up like reversing the pin and using the tights and cheating to get the first win. So it kind of already put, it's kind of like they get their cake and eat it too, because you get to have this cool Steamboat come in with the super hot face opening, but then Rude, he still ends up behind the eight ball because Rude gets the advantage and cheats to get the first fall and kind of sets up the rest of the match. And just everything they do is so tight. They like, they're both just like sweating their asses off by the end of this because they're just expending every little thing they have. Everything in this match is so tight. Like all the moves are tight. It really just looks like a fantastic athletic competition between two guys who are trying to show they're better than each other. I love, there's so many great spots in here. Like it's, like I said, it's just all so tight. It all makes sense in the story of the match. You get the obvious, what you're going to get, which is the flurry. I forget exactly what the, it is at the beginning, but they do the Bret Hart finish, I call it, at the end, where they Steamboat, it's like, I'm trying to make sure I remember, I'm pretty sure Steamboat wins this, right?
Yes.
I get so caught up in it that I forget. It's like, but that's a good sign for a match where I don't even remember who wins, because I'm just like, this is so good. Yeah, they do the Bret Hart, like he kicks off the turnbuckle. I call it the Bret Hart finish, like from the even though this is before, but the so what he does with Perfect and Steve Austin and that sort of thing, but where he like kicks off the buckle and kind of rolls them up, it's really cool. The crowd's right behind him. You get the, of course, the flurry at the end where they're just trying to get the last pinfall. Rude's trying to get it, but man, I just love the exhaustion of this. They're both just come off looking like such stud athletes. It's just a complete war from beginning to end. It's like everything they do looks like they're trying to get a pinfall and they're trying to win the match without it becoming boring. Like I said, they avoid a lot of the pitfalls of an Iron Man match where there's not a lot of, it's slow in some places, but not in a, we're just trying to kill time because we know we have to go an hour, which again, I think is why the 30 minutes is so awesome here. It really benefits the match that they don't have to waste any time. But man, I just love this one so much. I could watch it. It's just so grueling. Like I said, I think that's my main thing with it, is I just love the way it combines the athletic contest, because it really does feel like two prime athletes like going at each other and expending all their energy. But then at the same time, it's like a grudge match even without the brutality, I guess, which I think is really awesome. I don't know. I think you had this one pretty too high too, Tyler. I think you had a 21.
Yes, I had it at 21. This finished as match number 14 on the overall list. So now, first off, by saying I do remember you and JT watching this, because I was listening to it, and I'm glad you went back and watched it again in more detail, because I remember it got pretty late and you're like, I don't think there's been any falls. No, I think maybe that's the first fall. I'm like,
yeah, we were just like talking. I don't think either one of us is paying enough attention. It's I think we quickly realized that when you're trying to watch matches for this purpose, it's maybe not the best. I think that's why this is kind of a short lift pod, because I think we realized like it's hard to kind of talk through them and watch it with enough of a lens. Like when you're doing a project like this where you really want to try and pay attention to everything that's going on, maybe a live watch is the best, because you get situations like this where it's an Iron Man and neither one of you knows how many falls there were at the end of the match.
And commentary helps out a lot on stuff like this, because I've noticed even watching some matches that there's no commentary, or if it's a match from another country or it's in a different language that I don't understand, which is anything but English and probably even some parts of English, like you'll see a really close near fall and you're like, what the hell happened? That was it. And maybe it wasn't, or, you know, whatever. So anyway, I do share your love for this match, though. I believe this is the first Iron Man match by either of the big two and the first high profile match, Iron Man match, at least in North America, and at least that I've heard of. So, and one of the things that I liked about it is I feel like this did probably the best job of incorporating the psychology and the strategy of an Iron Man match, as opposed to just any other match or a match where it's going long. And I agree, like 30 minutes seems like it would be the perfect time for an Iron Man match. I'm somewhat using the fact that this match is so awesome and there are some long ones, you know, some hour long ones that I don't care for so much. And that's kind of what I'm basing that on. But So you mentioned Steamboat dominating the first fall, but then Rude getting a fall kind of out of nowhere. And I really like that. Jesse compares it to a hockey team getting a lot of shots on goal with the opponent scoring on their first shot.
Yes.
And I don't know anything about hockey, but that seems dead on. I kind of get the reference. So, and Rude hits a rude awakening like 30 seconds after that to go up 2-0. And so, they're getting the typology just right there. Like that was a really good way to kind of keep the structure like you would a normal match where Steamboat gets that, he looks good to start, good flurry, good shine. And then yet he's behind, so he's always fighting back. So it's the same psychology that you see in every war games where the heel has the advantage and the face trying to come back. So, and then Rude hits a knee off the top rope, which was a disqualification at this time, coming off the top rope at all. So he drops the fall on the DQ, but he thought the punishment would be enough. And Rude immediately gets an inside cradle to get the fall right back. So sometime I would like to see the heel like get a DQ and then get two falls. So it made sense, but at least the strategy behind it was solid. And him going up 3-0, I think that was the thought where he could just kind of put in a deep freeze and hang on, from at that point. And Rude kind of tries to do that a little bit. He starts to slow things down a little bit about that time. It was also about this time where Rude tries the swivel and he sells the ribs, so he
hurt himself
in the swivel. I love that.
Great spot.
And Jesse praises that. What a gutsy performance. And I'm like, that's just so pro wrestling, every bit of that.
Yeah.
So, let's see. So then, of course, Steamboat makes his comeback. Rude hits a pile driver, but then he goes for another one, and Steamboat, I think this is an awesome spot. He uses Rude as a ladder and just, walks up him. He's in a pile driver position, walks up him to reverse it, and then he gets his own pile driver. So now it's 3-2. And then shortly thereafter, he ties it up. And then when it's 3-3, Pace is immediately picking up. Steamboat's going for tons of near falls. Rude goes for the Rude Awakening. Steamboat counters. And then he gets a Rude Awakening as well, but it doesn't get the fall, which I like because it's Rude's finisher. So, and then you mentioned the Brett finish. So that's about 30 seconds left. And then Steamboat hits that and takes the 4-3 lead. And then Rude's immediately just manic in this because he has kind of been stalling. He had a sleeper on at one point, which makes a lot of sense in a match like this, a long match and one where they're obviously tired. But he's just like, it's like, I fucked up. Now I've got to get it back. I can get it back. And he goes for 5 covers in the last 30 seconds. Because I knew that, there was this manic burst. So I counted. He went 5 near falls in the last 30 seconds. I just thought it's fantastic strategy and psychology for an Iron Man match. And I think this is the best Iron Man match that I've seen. So I like Triple H Rock, but I think this is better. So, and
agree.
Yeah.
I really think it's the 30 minutes. I think the 30 minutes helps, honestly.
It definitely does. And
because it's you can do all the cool psychology things of like they do in this match with working, like you said, where he's kind of stalling because he thinks he's ahead, but then it comes back to, but you can do all the, like you could still have all the same psychology. You just, I don't think you don't have to fill up an hour of time. So a lot of, like I said, that's why I love how fast this one starts because it's such a trope in these sort of matches where you have to kind of start slow and, kill a little bit of time because you can't go balls to the wall for an hour because you're human beings, right. as we've been told many times, there's no timeouts in wrestling, Tyler.
That's right. Despite Arn Anderson calling one every match he's ever been in. But I bet.
Yeah, true.
All right. So let's see. Oh, that would take me to my number 8. And so my number 8 is the original War Games match. Dusty Rhodes, Nikita Koloff, Road Warrior, Animal Road Warrior, Hawk, Paul Ellering versus Ric Flair, Arn Anderson, Lex Luger, Tully Blanchard, and J.J. Dillon. So, like I said, this is the original war game, so it's in the Great American Bash from 1987. This finished as match number 10 on the overall loader composite list. So Arn Anderson and Dusty Rhodes are the first two participants in War Games, and I think they are the perfect choices because some of the things we've talked about before, Arn sells and stooges, and Dusty's just so over, and he gets the fans into his offense, and it's, I mean, you know, the flip-flop and fly and the elbows and the dancing and everything. Some of it's kind of goofy, but it's perfect for this spot. So Arn's bleeding just immediately, and Dusty rakes it against the roof of the cage in a nice spot. So the ref actually flips the coin this time, and shocker, the heels win to start a long tradition of the heels winning the coin toss. Tully's in next, and he and Arn show really good teamwork, and they control, and they try to break Dusty's leg, but Animal's in just in time to save, and slingshots Tully into the cage multiple times. So now Dusty and Tully are both bleeding. So I guess everyone, Arn, Dusty, and Tully are all bleeding at this point. Flair's in next, so the horsemen regain the advantage. And at some point, Tully puts Dusty's leg between the rings and kicks at it. So you see that happen a lot where somebody falls between the rings. But here, he was like kicking at it, so it kind of made a lot of sense that he was going through the leg doing that. Nikita's in next, and the crowd's going wild when he double clotheslines Flair and Arn. So this is already just a glorious, violent chaos. Flair's bleeding as Lex is in next for the horsemen. So, and I'm shocked that all of these people are immediately just bleeding. So, but here we are. So, Lex holds Nikita for a Flair nut shot. And Tully and Flair hit a spike pile driver on Nikita. So these are some really violent spots, too. They're not just, you know, wandering around and hitting a few punches here. They're going after it. So, Pox in next, and he runs wild. Flair with another nut shot on the Warriors and puts Dusty in a figure four, but he has to break to save JJ from Hawk. I might have skipped a few entries here, but so JJ was in and about to get worked over by the Road Warriors, but Flair had to break from the figure four. Then Ellering comes in next, start the match beyond, and Tony points out that with Ellering as the freshman, that actually gives an advantage to the faces, which I thought was a nice point. The faces work together and they kind of keep the horsemen at bay, and that leaves the Road Warriors to work over JJ, who's also bleeding and just getting the shit kicked out of him. So Blair's got his blonde hair turned red and he's digging like a spiked dog collar or something into Dusty's head, and said that I don't know if that was the Road Warriors gear or was just happened. Flair just happened to have it in his overnight bag for reasons. So could go either way, not sure. But JJ surrenders, but I'm not exactly sure why. It looked like the Road Warriors were just kind of stomping on him. And that's my only flaw with this match was I wish the reason for the finish had been clearer, even like hearing him surrender or be in a submission hold of any kind, I think would have helped matters a little bit. But I think they got that cleared up pretty quickly. So earlier, the Road Warriors had rammed him into the cage. And afterwards, I watched this on my War Games DVD comp that the WWE put out a number of years ago. And so Dusty Rhodes would have these little interviews between all the matches because it was his concept. And he said that when the Warriors rammed it, JJ into the ring, into the cage, they broke his collarbone, so he didn't want to do it anymore. So it may very well have been, well,
like a shoot surrender.
Yeah, right. Like, I don't know what spot you have next, but fuck that, I'm done. Because I mean, it was pretty clear reading the participants, you pretty much knew who was going to submit or surrender. You know, knew who was doing the job on that one, I think. So I wouldn't blame him at all if he's like, I'm losing anyway, man. Let's just call it. Let's call it a night.
Oh God! But when they have JJ in there, it's like they're ritually slaughtering like a pig or something. Like poor JJ is just getting his ass kicked as soon as he gets in there.
Yeah. Oh, and it, I mean, the way they do it is perfect. They hold off, you know, the other horsemen, and then to get the Road Warriors against J.J. Dillon, it's like, well, that's all she wrote here. So, but I do think, you know, for this as a kickoff of War Games, that's probably my favorite gimmick match. And I think all these guys are very well suited to this type of match. And for the most part, WCW, or at this point, the NWA, Jim Crockett Promotions, did a pretty good job of putting guys in really good position to succeed. So guys like the Road Warriors and Nikita and Lex that are big, you know, big hosses that come in and do great House of Fire, you know, they were the babyface side. They all did well. So
Yeah,
anyway.
this is. I should have had this one higher. I don't know why. I mean, it's not like I had it that low. I still had a top 40 out of like 39, but man, that's underrated because I rewatched this and this is a banging match. Like, this is definitely spoilers for a little bit later, but it's not my favorite War Games. But man, it's definitely, I think, the wildest, like the most insane crowd. I don't know about most insane crowd, but definitely the most chaotic, I think, of all of them. Like, there's just a point. And I think maybe that could be if you're going to find a weakness with it compared to the one that are like better. Maybe that's why, because it does become madness like you want in War Games, but it maybe breaks down a bit. But man, it is just so chaotic. Like, I do like the manager tie-in. Like you said, maybe the finish is, you know, with JJ is a little bit too, and I guess it kind of protects all the guys too in this sort of match. But anyway, it kind of maybe, you know, if you're nitpicking, but it's so good. The savagery, like when they double team Dusty, is so good. The pop when I want to say it's Animal that comes in first, right? When he comes in, the pop is just, man, the roof blows off that place whenever Animal comes in and starts cleaning the house. Like you said, like these power guys are so good in this because you had the guys like Arnold and Flair and I guess JJ and Tully and all these guys who are going to take these bumps, and then you have all these powerhouse guys. Like at one point, Nikita is just like no selling the chops, and like the crowd's just completely losing their shit at it. Just, you know, like just making these guys look so good. It's yeah, for the first one, it's like, man, they really set the standard pretty high with this. And I mean, they loaded it for sure by having the people that they did in it, but man, it's so awesome. I just love the heat of all of it. It's so insane. Like, I think it might be the most insane one, just like complete madness, which is so awesome. And so it kind of sets the tone for the later ones that this is what this match is about, where you, like in any good war games, you're always going to have that moment where all these guys in here, you honestly don't really know what's going on, and that's like the beauty of it. And they set that right from the beginning with this one.
Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful chaos.
All right, so we'll now go to my number seven, which we'll talk about in just a moment, which would be Magnum and Tully I Quit match from Starrcade '85, which you have higher. So we'll roll on to your number seven, which was my number nine.
Correct. Okay. My number seven is Rey Mysterio Jr. versus Eddie Guerrero, the Cruiserweight title at Halloween Havoc 1997. It was title versus mask. So, this match finished as number six on the voter composite list. I was listening to the alternative commentary of Michael Cole with Eddie and Ray from Eddie's WWE DVD. If I had been able to figure out how to get to regular commentary, I would have done so, but it was kind of neat to hear that. But I will have missed any gems and golden nuggets from commentary, so feel free to add those in, Jake. They start off with just the immediate fast pace, which is basically what you would expect. Crisp moves, excitement right from the start. On the commentary, Ray said that he had beef with Bischoff that night, and they said because his mask was on the line, which I don't know if they were trying to keep some kayfabe or if he really didn't, they didn't want to do that that stiff to begin with. But Eddie told him that he'd take care of him and that the only way for them to shove it up Bischoff's butt was in the ring. And I'd say that this match did any butt shoving they were looking for because it rules. Eddie takes over on the outside, then he slingshots back in and hits a senton. And Eddie tells a story of unmasking intentionally in Mexico, which was a big deal and disrespectful. So big heel heat, I guess. I've seen the match, but I don't pretend to know much of the backstory there. But it's odd that Eddie doesn't say much about it. And despite Eddie being the one that got really good on the mic, and this is his DVD, he's pretty quiet about this match, but Ray talks a lot about it and gives a lot of insight. And I never thought he was, I never thought his mic work was a strength. So that was interesting to me. This time in the match, though, Eddie's trying to rip at the mask, and he's using a lot of power moves, like a backbreaker, which is pretty rare that Eddie has a size advantage, but he works it quite well. Ray goes, this is just an amazing series. Ray goes from a knuckle lock to jumping to the top rope, but in the middle, not like even on a turnbuckle. And he springboards back into a moonsault that catches Eddie on the way down for a DDT. And that, I mean, that is just phenomenally smooth. Like, if you've watched this match recently, you probably know the spot I'm talking about. And I had that, I think that Ray tried this other times, at least the moonsault DDT part, but it never looked that good. And right on cue on the commentary, Ray said that he'd never done it before and was never able to do it again. So take that for what it's worth. I think that Ray is a little bit falsely modest, that we'll see how that comes into play. But he calls it a backflip DDT. So I suppose that's the official name now. Eddie hits a dropkick, knocking Ray outside, and Eddie works him over again. And once they're back in the ring, Eddie's just ripping at the mask again. So he's doing a good job playing the heel here. He gets a gory special, as Ray, of course, is, you know, selling and playing a good underdog. Ray, on the commentary, calls his style generic high flying, but I beg to differ. That's where I would argue with him greatly, because I don't think there's anything generic about Ray's style at this point. So, and Eddie, as he compares the way Ray flies to the way Jordan dunks a basketball, and I think that's far more accurate, because every flyer did not look like Ray did in 1997. Eddie misses a baseball slide, hitting his solar plexus on the post. Ray hits a slash from the top rope to the floor. Cole makes a comment that he thinks Ray debuted at age 8, and Ray corrects him that it was 15. So I assume he was trying to be a smartass there, but I never know. Part of me thinks maybe Cole really did think Ray was out there wrestling around at
very possible.
8. Yeah. Although it is kind of interesting to hear Cole, when he doesn't have anyone yelling at his ear or hasn't been, you know, scripted to death with the PR phrases, he's more tolerable, I'll say. Ray snaps off a beautiful Rana and, hold on just a second. Lost my place here. Okay. Yeah, Ray snaps off just a beautiful Hurricane Rana, and at this point, Cole did kind of piss me off because he called it the West Coast Pop, but whatever. I mean, I understand. That's what they were calling it at the time, but still, like, didn't seem to fit here. I'm like, this is WCW, damn it. And then Ray hits some kind of a 619 thing before it was a 619 into a head scissors and jumps outside and hits a Rana, and he said he only pulled that one off twice, and the other time was in Mexico with Eddie. And I think I was taking notes and didn't see exactly what was so unique about it. So, you know, there are a lot of the times where his combinations are just a little bit different to make it unique, but he hits all kinds of, he can hit the Rana from anywhere, which has been the theme in a lot of his matches. So Eddie hits a big power bomb for a close near fall, and that really looked good, and the crowd's telling him he sucks, so they are very into this match. Ray's picking up the pace and springboards into the ring, and Eddie catches him in a backbreaker, and he goes up for the frog splash, but he misses, but he rolls through, and then the finish comes when Eddie goes for a splash mountain, but Ray reverses it to a Rana roll-up for the win to keep his mask. I mean, because even WCW wouldn't be so dumb to unmask Ray when they could sell all those masks to kids, right?
At least not yet.
Never mind. Yeah. Never mind. But
Sell those horns, Tyler. We'll sell the horns, okay?
I suppose so. And I will say, as ridiculous as he looked then, he was good even then. So, it gets shit on. But I'm like, he was pretty good in the ring, despite looking. I don't even know what he looked like. But we'll not speak of that because this is prime 1997 Rey Mysterio and Eddie Guerrero. So, so this was a great match. Everything went so smoothly. And I think that Rey said after on that same commentary that this was the only time he hit a top rope Rana. And I'm like, that's BS because the Psychosis match had the same finish. So, I don't know what. I don't know. Maybe there is something this was just a little bit different. And if you weren't just a dumb mark, you'd know that. And that may be true. But I'm pretty sure I've seen you do. It certainly looked the same to me anyway. Eddie attacked after the match to kind of get his heel heat back. But, this one, what more can you say? This is kind of, we're getting into where every match is legendary here, Jake.
Yeah, this one. So we were pretty locked in on this one. We're only two spots away, both in the top 10. The only things I add is just, man, I think what makes this one so great, because there's a lot of really good these, whatever you want to call it, lucha matches, for lack of a better term, and just kind of what the reputation is. But I think what elevates this one and makes it so good is that it kind of, because the big critique on this style of match, if you want to call it that, is is that it has these cool moves and stuff, but maybe it doesn't, compared to some of these other matches we're going to talk about, in this top 10, it captures that this style doesn't capture the emotion or have storytelling or anything like this. And I think with this match, it has all of it. It has the amazing spots, all those spots you were saying. One that really stood out to me is there's just so many great counters in this, just excellent counter wrestling. But when Rey does the springboard and Eddie just catches him and hits him with the tightest bat breaker you've ever seen, it's just, God, they were just so locked in. Eddie is so good too. I feel like this is you see it from him here, showing that aggression in this run, and particularly in this match. That's kind of been, I'm watching a lot of Eddie right now doing the 2002 stuff on the Ruthlessly Aggressive podcast, and you can definitely see it here. And it's his signature in his kind of in that early 2000s run in WWE. It's just that aggression. He's such a pit bull. He's so focused on what he's doing. And he shows that in this match, cutting off everything Rey's doing, he's just cutting it off, reversing it, and just looks like he's trying to, he's so cruel. You have the mask thing. So like I said, you have this emotion to the match that I think maybe a lot of matches that are based on a lot of these cool spots don't really have. But with this one, you kind of get both. And I think that's what elevates it to being so great. And just that final image too, I think is amazing. After Rey is able to win and he's so emotional, and you see him in half of his mask is kind of torn, he has the eyes kind of peel back a little bit, and it's just a cool image. And they do great camera work to WCW's credit. They were not always the best at this kind of stuff with the camera work and stuff, but man, it's a great shot when they close in on him. He's looking at the belt and his mask is torn, and then Eddie just comes and clobbers him in the back, and he has to kind of scurry away. But just the whole package. So, like I said, it's you get all the great wrestling, but the emotions there too. And I think that's why this is such a legendary match.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. All right. So we will now head to my number 6, which would be a pairing that we've talked about quite a bit doing these pods for good reason too. But this would be my favorite of their series of matches. So this would be Sting and Vader. For the world title from Great American Bash 92, which is the OG Vader Sting match. That could be the reason why I put it first, because I think with a lot of these, as I'm coming into these final ones where you have a lot of these matches where it's a series and I've ranked multiple matches from the guys. So obviously we had a couple of Vader Sting matches already. So I was just trying to think, because they're going to do a lot of the same strengths are going to be there in each match, because the guys just have that sort of chemistry. And so besides the thing we've already talked about in our previous episodes with the Vader Sting stuff, is I think what I like about this one is that it has maybe the novelty of the newness of it, of seeing Sting go against Vader for the first time and how he's going to handle this. And I love because I think the story of this match is that, you know, I think when people think back to it, generally, a lot of it is like, well, Sting just gets destroyed the whole match, which he kind of does, but he gets a lot of, he gets a decent amount of offense too. Like when I rewatch this, I always have in my head like that Sting just going to take, just get destroyed the whole match. And he doesn't really. I feel like they do a really good job though of, as the match goes on, he slowly realizes like he wasn't really prepared. Like as much as he thought he was prepared for what, like Vader's brutality and stuff, it's like he slowly, like he's caught off guard, and eventually as the match goes on, he can't outlast him. And I think it's really cool. And they play off of it in the matches that follow, but it kind of sets the table for these two and shows kind of what their chemistry is. And we've talked about it before. It's just so good because Sting is perfect for him because he's smaller than Vader in the sense that, you know, Vader still looks like a monster against him, but Sting is big enough and powerful enough to where he can hit some stuff on Vader and it looks believable. Like when Sting hits a drop kick on Vader, you can believe that it's going to knock him off his feet. Or if Sting runs at him with a really strong clothesline, it's going to be powerful enough to actually do some damage. So I think that's why it works so well. But then Sting is just a great babyface, and he knows how to sell and get sympathy, and the crowd loves him, and so it really works. So I just love the way that as the match goes on, it's like Sting, he's like the ultimate face hero, so he's never going to back down. But just as it goes on, Vader just keeps clubbing him, and Sting's trying to survive, and then eventually he just can't handle anymore, and Vader just destroys him by the end of it and wins the title. The crowd's in shock. That's a great moment because they're just thinking, like, you're just expecting Sting, you know, the ultimate babyface hero is going to come back and win the match and overcome the odds, and he doesn't. He fights and fights and fights, and then he just gets crushed in the end, and it's not enough. And I like, too, that Vader's sort of caught off guard, too. Like, Sting's caught off guard by how powerful and dominant Vader is. And you could tell there's a lot of moments in the match where Vader's kind of, he's so used to crushing everybody. And then Sting comes in and it's like giving him more than what he's used to, too. So he's kind of like, it makes him fire up and go after Sting, you know, even more than he normally does. So it's an awesome dynamic. It's a great heel moment to just think like, but like at the end of the match, it's like, holy shit, he just won. He just beat Sting. He just crushed him in the end. Because like I said, you're just like the crowd. You're thinking Sting's got to come back. That's what Sting does. And he just doesn't. You know, it's a cool story. And it leads to what would become the next year for these two guys going back and forth with each other. But if I had to guess, I think that's why I picked this one. Because it just kind of sets the tone for what these two are. And I think it's just the novelty of it. You could feel it. It's like both guys getting used to each other. You could see the crowd kind of seeing what these two guys are going to be like together. And I think for me, that's maybe what bumps it over the other ones. But they're all great. But this one, I think, particularly, I like the most.
Yeah, well, you know, they tell a great story. There's a great story arc over all three matches. So this match finished number 17 overall on the voter list. And I had it as match 27. So I guess I was opposite of you there, Jake, in that I had it the third of the three. But again, they were all three in my top 30. So, you know, you can't complain about that. So, and like you mentioned, Vader just manhandled Sting right from the start. And I feel like this might be the first match where you really see Sting work from underneath. And if it's not the first, it's certainly one of the first. And I think he's just better at that. I think that's one of his real strengths, which, you know, was a challenge sometimes because he was often either the bigger guy or going to get a guy like Flair who's similar size. He's always going to be like, Flair's always going to be cheating. He's not going to be a dominant. So I think this was just the best match up for him. So, but you know, because it's almost, you know, almost a borderline squash early, that makes all Sting's hope spots really electric. I had that this was kind of a rare Sting blade job, and I like Ross calls that before he could have possibly seen. I said, Sting's bleeding. I'm like, well, he ran his head into the post. I'm sure you know that he's bleeding at this point, and any of us could probably guess it, but you certainly can't see his face yet. But whatever, he was right. And the finish, man, Vader just hits the powerbomb and Sting's just a rag doll and very dead. Like the pin is, he just kind of throws his leg over him and he just looks dead. And like you said, you're like, holy shit. And Vader's the world champ. So what I equate this to, like Cena Brock before Cena Brock, or maybe this is what Cena Brock likely drew inspiration from. So I think this was more of their Extreme Rules 2012 match than the pure squash that was the SummerSlam 14. And I like both matches, but I love that Extreme Rules match. So this is a great first chapter. And indeed, that was the case, because they went on to have, you know, two more matches that were great. And I think they had at least one more. What was that?
Oh, it's a tough thing, you know, going through these, because it's happening a lot. It's about to happen again as we get into the top five, which I won't think will be like a shocking matches that we're going to get into. But just when you have these, I think it's a testament to, you know, I think it's a strength of WCW and NWA at this time, and how they were able to put on these series of matches where it's very difficult to really like pick one, you know, like of all these Sting Vader matches. For me, it was kind of like just trying to figure out which one I liked the best. But I felt like a lot of times I was splitting hairs a little bit, because for a lot of them, it's not like they just have one match that's much better than all the other ones. It's like they have these series where every match is pretty damn good, and all in the same realm. So you kind of have to nitpick a little bit to figure out which one you like. But they were so good, and they all play off of each other and stuff. So it was definitely a strength, just as we're getting towards the end of this WCW list, of just something I noticed as we're going back through this. It's just so good, these pairings of guys, and they have these series of matches, and they're all pretty good. Like we talked about with Flair and Luger, Sting and Vader. Like, you have all these pairings, and it's hard to pick one. You know, I struggled when I was doing this to try and figure out, you know, well, why would I pick this Vader Sting over the other ones? Because I'm thinking back, and like, the strap match is so good, and they're all just so good.
Yeah, I think I had the strap match as my top one, and I think it's because the brutality escalates in the future matches, and that tends to be something that usually hits with me. But I mean, you can't go wrong with Sting Vader, and I think Sting was the perfect guy to tell this story, because he had enough credit with the fans to give a lot to Vader and still look like a hero facing adversity. So I think that WCW and the stars really did a great job of having something different in every match, and we'll see that in some of these future matchups as well. I think there's a little something different in all their matches. So it just depends on whatever speaks to you most directly there. So. And going on to my number six match, that is also a match that we have talked about this matchup before. And that is Barry Windham versus Ric Flair from Worldwide, January 24th, 1987. So this match finished as match 15 on the voter list. And it starts with a lot of mat work and reversals. Barry is this young up-and-comer baby face here, and the fans are just chanting his name early. It's almost weird to see Barry looking this young and spry. So and he focuses on the headlock early, and he shows that he's not intimidated or taking any of Flair's shit. They have this really quick pace early. Knowing how long this match goes, it really kind of stands out. There's no rest holds really, at least early, you know, the headlock, but it doesn't feel like a rest hold. They're always kind of going for things out of it. Barry goes to a head scissors after the commercial break, and then back to the headlock, and Flair tosses him, and he works him over outside, and that's how he takes over. They're always doing something as opposed to resting. So Barry's selling well, but he fires up with right hands, and just, he always looks like a standing tall baby face, which makes sense, because he's a big guy. He's not going to just sell forever and die. But Flair cheats liberally, and since Barry, like I just said, Barry's bigger, so he's playing off Barry being inexperienced and Flair being a cheating. My notes say Flair being a cheating shirt, but I believe what I meant to say is Flair being a cheating shit helps them get fans reacting how they want to. So Flair with the figure four holding the ropes, and I assume Flair did that move in the world. You know, he's got the figure four on, got to grab a hold of the umbilical cord here while I'm getting the figure four on. So, Wyndham's legs hurt, as Dusty on commentary says that there's something about a one-legged man in a hiney kicking contest, as Dusty is wont to do. That's one of his chestnuts. Barry hits a nice sunset flip into the ring for two, and Flair hits a sleeper, but Barry hits a top rope clothesline for two, but he hits knees on the splash, and I just can't really keep up with the action about 30 to 40 minutes in of what's shown. So it's probably longer with commercial breaks. Barry plays a really great standing tall baby face, just does everything so well at such a young age. It's a really great flurry right at the end. As Barry tries to put Flair away with suplexes, punches, and clotheslines, and he winds up covering Flair just as time expires. So Flair was literally saved by the bell on that one. And, you know, Flair made Wyndham look like $1 million, but Barry was game to keep up with the Nature Boy. And, you know, Flair just does that time after time. He always makes the opponent look good, and this was a great example. And Wyndham's just uber talented, so to try to make him look good is not, you know, a particularly tall order to begin with. So I just thought that it really hit here. And both Meltzer and Chad Campbell had called this the best US TV match, excluding Clash matches. And I don't think I can argue. I certainly can't think of anything. This is my highest TV match on this list, and there was nothing on the WWE list that would have touched it, I don't think. So, and obviously, between Chad and Meltzer, obviously I hold the opinion of the guy that's on the no-so feed in higher regard than that other guy. But as we all would.
Obviously. Yeah, it's fantastic. At 11, it's just a great wrestling match. I don't know. It's like you said, it's hard to really go through everything spot for spot and say it, but it's just all so smooth and well done, and everything feels so natural. I had noted, too, particularly that the closing stretch when they just bring it all home is so the furiousness of that closing stretch is just awesome. But yeah, I'd have to think definitely. I mean, obviously for WCW, because same as you, I don't think I have any TV matches ahead of it. So yeah, maybe so. Maybe Chad's on to something there.
Yeah, maybe.
But anyway.
Maybe Chad knows something about wrestling.
Oh, no. All right. So with that, we will go to my number five. So we're getting to the top five and about to bust it open here. So the first of many that we're about to talk about. So my number five would be Flair Steamboat for the world title at Wrestle War 89. So, man, like this one, it's almost hard to talk about these matches because they're like, for one, it's like their chemistry is just off the charts. Like everything they do is so tight, even when they do basic stuff. And I think it's the story of a lot of these matches, because obviously we're about to go through the whole trilogy of them, these 89 matches with Flair and Steamboat. It's just a matter of what order each of us put them in. But I think just overall, as we get into them, the thing about all these matches that's so awesome is like, it's not like, and that's why it's kind of hard to go through and pick all, for me to go back and pick all these like spots, because the stuff that they do is not, you know, they're not doing tons of complicated stuff really. Like a lot of it is like chops and Steamboat with the arm drags and headlocks and, you know, basic stuff you could sort of say, but it's just the way they do it and the way they piece it all together. It's just so fantastic. Like everything's so tight. It ebbs and flows so well. The momentum swings are great. Like in this one, I love that. Like in the early part of this one, in the Wrestle War match, Steamboat's constantly going for it in the early going. He's trying to hit that cross body, but it's not working for him, and it's kind of biting him in the ass because that's how Flair keeps coming back at him. So just these little details like that they work in. It's really nothing. You know, it's nothing crazy. It's not any crazy spots or anything like that. It's just constantly going back and forth and everything being tight and everything feels like it makes sense. And it feels like, and I think it's a known thing, you know, and that was the thing, I guess, with Steamboat and Savage, is that Savage would always want to play in these matches out. And I feel like these two guys are kind of known for kind of just going with the flow and kind of calling the ring. And you could definitely feel it in these matches because they just kind of roll with it and they just go to the next spot and they just have almost like an innate sense of what to do next. And it just feels right when they do it. And it's hard to even kind of explain. But this one, so this would have been my the lowest one for me. And I think for you too, right, Tyler? You have it.
I have Wrestle War at number four on my list, and I have
yes,
Chi-Town Rumble at number five, and I have Wrestle War at number four. But Wrestle War would be the next one for us to talk about. So, if you want to go ahead and keep talking about Wrestle War, it's my number four.
Yeah, sorry, I got a little mixed up with these because we have them all. We kind of have them tightly packed together, I guess. So anyway, I have it number five. You had it number four. But yeah, in this, so this would be the end of the trilogy, and it really does feel like a respect match compared to some of the other ones, and maybe that's why I had it lower, because that is cool to me. But I do like the other ones a bit more because this one is a respect match. It doesn't kind of have. Because the ending obviously is, Flair, he wins the title back and then they do the handshake thing and he kind of turns face a little bit. So the whole vibe of the match sort of fits that because it didn't quite have the I don't know if the feud was really about hate, but it doesn't have like the grudge to it that some of them ones does. So maybe that's why I have it lower, but it's still just technically amazing. Yeah, you want to speak on this one now, Tyler, since you had it, and then we'll...
Yeah, so this match finished number five on the voter list. So it was your number five, so you had the finger right on the pulse with the viewers or with the voters on this one. So, and I had it one spot higher at four. And I think the fact that it winds up being a baby face match is one of the things that I appreciated out of it, because Flair hasn't actually turned yet, but it plays in. I note several times that he doesn't cheat. So he does bring a bunch of women for his entrance, while Steamboat brings out his kid on a pony, literally on a pony. they have the judges at ringside to determine the winner if it's a draw. Lee says, Pat O'Connor and Cue Ominous Music, Terry Funk.
Much better judging panel than Great American Bash 1990 or whatever with Flair and Sting, where you have what's his name from Wonder Years and all. I think this is a much more credible judging panel.
Yes, there was someone from there was a Penthouse Pet of the Year on that one. So this one it makes sense in the context of the match. I mean, the panel, like you said, is very, very qualified. And it makes sense because of the ending of their clash match as well. So, Ross notes that the fact that they have the judges will make this a very offensive-based match because both guys want to impress them. And right on cue, they have a great chop exchange up in the ante. Cottle mentions that Steamboat's the only man to make Flair submit to the double chicken wing. And right as he says that, Steamboat's working the arm. And Cottle also says that he thinks Steamboat just matches up better with Flair than other wrestlers do, which I thought was a really good point, because that happens all the time in real sports. There'll be a team that's, generally considered a better team, but they just for whatever reason don't match up as well. And I thought that was it was interesting to think of that from a wrestling perspective. The announcers talked about Steamboat being ahead on points early in the match and mentioned working the arm and the shoulder for the chicken wing. And the judges agree as Steamboat wins the first 15 minutes on the scorecard. So I like how they're using that, and it gives a good way to add kind of a level, add kind of a layer of psychology to this one. So Flair's fighting back and forth, and I note early on that Flair's not really cheating, even though Ross calls a few moves cheap shots. He doesn't cheat like Flair normally does. They go outside, but Steamboat goes out in front of the ref, who determined it was his momentum instead of Flair throwing him out behind the ref's back like he normally would. The chops in action are just incredible, like you'd expect with these guys. Steamboat goes back to the arms, keep working that. He Steamboat goes for the flying crossbody, and he goes over the top. So Flair takes over again, but again, he's still not cheating. He didn't throw him over the top rope. Flair's getting a lot of near falls, and he's starting to get frustrated. Flair hits Steamboat with a suplex outside, and then Flair wins the next 15 minutes, but 2-1, whereas Steamboat won the first period unanimously, so he's still ahead on points. So they're kind of telling the story that, like, if it were to go, like, if it were to end right now, Steamboat wins, so Flair kind of has to, he has to do something to take the offense. So, and the action by now is just fast and furious. Ross is nearly has a stroke as both guys go out on the Steamboat crossbody. Steamboat takes over again. Everything's awesome. The crowd's going nuts. Steamboat hits the superflex, and then he goes for the chicken wing. But Flair gets his foot in the ropes, and Steamboat hits a chop from the top, and then he tries it again, but Flair falls into the ropes, and Steamboat falls to the floor, hurting his leg, and Flair goes right for it. You know, Flair gets the figure four, as Ross notes that he's won the world title on more than one occasion with this move, and Ross says that all the time, so that must be the case. I don't recall ever seeing any of those finishes, but it must have been some of his very early title wins. Steamboat breaks the hold, but Flair stays on the leg, but he has Steamboat's leg as he's trying to work it over, and Steamboat hits an enziguri. But then he tries a slam, and Flair gets an inside cradle for the win and title number 6. So, fantastic match, of course, and it plays off what came before with the chicken wing psychology and the finish, and what will come as Flair never cheated, and they shake hands afterwards, and Flair congratulates and puts over Steamboat. And, you know, he doesn't always do that. That's not something Flair always says. He can usually put his opponent over on the mic, but not saying that they're a great wrestler and that sort of thing. Not, this is very much more of a babyface Ric Flair promotion. And then Terry Funk gets in the ring to, he tells Flair congratulations and that he'd have voted for him if it went 60 minutes. And then he asks if he can challenge for the title. And Flair hits some great lines here. He's has a great promo. He says, Flair's been rubbing shoulders with Sylvester Stallone, and the world champion has to defend against the top 10, and you're not in the top 10. Funk says, oh, well, I was only kidding, Rick. I was only kidding. He asked if Flair thinks he isn't good enough. But then he says, oh, I was just kidding. I was only kidding, Rick. But it turns out he was not kidding, as he beat the ever-loving shit out of Flair, including pile driving him on the table and then hitting his neck with a chair. Funk says to look at the horse-teeth, banana-nosed jerk who said he wasn't good enough now. And that's just an incredible turn. And it's an incredible angle. It's an incredible beatdown after an incredible match. And that's why I noted that Flair didn't cheat all through the match, because he knew he was turning babyface. And he preserved that. And I thought he did a great job doing that. I really had to look for it. You know, I've seen the match numerous times. I think I was looking for these things more. So I just thought it was a tremendous package. And, Jake, we're at this point where these top 5 matches are all just unreal. Like, watching this one back, it really hit with me. And I'm like, these matches should all be number 1. They all just tie for number 1. It's too hard to make these determinations, I think.
Yeah, like we're getting, like I said, with the Sting Vader stuff in these, it's hard to really, especially because, like you're saying, they play off of things. By the way, I think chicken wing psychology is what I majored in college, and that's why my physique is what it is. But yeah, like nice. You said, the chicken, which is an awesome spot. I love that in these matches. The chicken wing is so good. Like, and I think to what I was saying too is they do kind of use a lot of basic stuff. So when they do bust out something like what he does, the chicken wing, you're like, oh shit, here's the chicken wing. Like, it's not like they do all these, you know, crazy moves and stuff to where, you know, when they do bust out things, it really does matter. But back to what I was saying, it's like, they all go together, so it's hard to really separate them. I mean, for the purposes of this, you do. And I noticed we almost both did it. I think you have one that's ahead of the pack a little bit, But I know for mine, I stacked them all together because I thought it was the only way to really do it. And, you know, to maybe put them one above the other, but they're all kind of in the same realm. So to me, it kind of made sense to stack them together. But anyway, so I kind of screwed us up a little bit. So that would be my lowest ranked one of the trilogy. And you actually had the Wrestle War in the middle. And then so your number five would be?
My number five was the Chi-Town Rumble.
Yes, which will bring us to my number four, because I have Chi-Town Rumble higher. And then so my number four would have been the Two Out of Three Falls from the Clash with Flair and Steamboat, which you have higher. We'll leave it at that for now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Wrestle War at number four. So that would have been your second ranked Flair Steamboat, which brings us now to my number three. Correct me if I'm screwing this up again. This would be number three on my list, which would be my highest ranked Flair Steamboat. Which could be controversial because so obviously I don't have a Flair Steamboat number one or number two, actually. So we'll get to those in a second. But my favorite of them, and this could be because, you know, us ADHD millennials or something, who knows. But it would be the Chi-Town Rumble from 1989 with Flair and Steamboat. And so this is the kind of the one that started it all. It's kind of interesting, too, because we've already talked about the match that sort of set up the whole trilogy earlier on our list, which I think is pretty cool, too. So we talked about when Steamboat made his return. So this is the one that kind of kicked it off. And I think it's why I like it so much is because, you know, maybe this one is not the technical masterpiece that the other ones are. And I think it really just comes down to my own personal taste and anyone when it comes to judging these. And I think this one, like, I do like the brevity of it, that it is a good bit shorter, obviously, than the other ones, and that it's only about 20 to 25 minutes. But I do like the intensity of this one because I feel like this one has a lot of pure heat to it because it's going off of what started the whole feud. And I like how much this whole match is about, that the story is, and it's kind of how the feud started, is that Flair pretty much kind of writes Steamboat off saying, like, you know, I'm a hot shot. I'm going out every night. I'm the champ. You know, I have women around me all. You just, you know, go home and change some diapers because you're just a family man. You're not good enough to be the world champion. And that's sort of the way they do this. And so he's kind of putting Steamboat down, like, you're not on the caliber of me. You know, you think you can just return and you'll be able to hang with me. It's not going to happen. Like, you don't have it anymore, blah, blah, blah. And so I like that that is sort of in this match. And I feel like this one has the best tension of all of them. Because it is the original, or maybe because you have that story to see how it's going to, you know, how this is going to play out when they first get in the ring. I guess maybe it's just my thing with these, because I did the same thing with Sting and Vader, where I picked the first one and put it highest. So maybe it's just me. I like the OG ones the best. Who knows? But I just like the story in this match of Steamboat proving as the match goes on that, like, even though, and they do a good job selling on commentary too, that even though he's like a family man, like, he's still going to fuck you up. And he proves it throughout the entire match, like, that Flair's coming at him and he just keeps coming. It's super physical. But Steamboat just keeps coming at him and he's unrelenting on him, and Flair's slowly picking up as the match goes on. Like, man, maybe I underestimated this guy because he came to play. Like, just because he has a family doesn't mean he can't wrestle. And just, like, I love the last sequence, just off the chain drama in the last weekend sequence when Steamboat finally wins. There's before the finish, there's just, man, maybe like the greatest sequence of flash pins I've ever seen. Like, it kind of reminds you of the Steamboat Savage match from WrestleMania 3, but they just do these, like, crazy reversals of flash pins, and it's towards the end of the match, and they built the heat. They built it so well throughout this entire match and made it so competitive that you easily feel. And because they, you know, I think because the style of the NWA and WCW is that, you know, I think maybe in WWF you'd be, you know, Bret Hart kind of made it, you know, kind of brought this more when in his singles run. But I think if you're watching WWF, you kind of wouldn't buy some of this because you're thinking, no, they got to hit the finish, you know, because you're so used to people having to hit the finishers. But in this style, you could easily see either one of these guys winning on one of these flash pins. And so the crowd's buying into it. You're buying into it. They do that. And then finally Steamboat wins. And it's like a great moment because he's proved in this match that he, you know, that even though he's not a hot shot like Flair, he's a wrestler and he's just as good a wrestler as Flair, and that he can take him down. And it's just cool. Like I said, I love that it's kind of the more condensed match of all of them. I like the brevity of it. I love the tension of it, and I love the story. And it's fantastic. So that's why this one would be my favorite. Do you have anything to add on this one? So I think this would have been we're kind of reversed on these. I think you had this one as your lowest ranked, even though lowest ranked means number five on your list.
Correct. Yeah. I had this number five. So, and yeah, that was the lowest of the three. So, this match finished number two overall on the list. So,
wow.
Jake, you had a lot of company, and people really loved this match. So, and you know, it's Flair Steamboat. You can't argue anything there. So they really play up the Playboy versus Family Man angle. But this also just had a really big match feel right from the get go. So they have an immediate quick pace and get a two count for Steamboat. So I assume somewhere Dave Meltzer is starting his near fall counter, hitting a check mark there. So, and you know, everything that you said about the match is, you know, it's just great. The intensity, but I kind of think that the angle does play a part in this, to their credit. Like, I feel like the NWA made a bit of a misstep with the angle, with Flair being so good on the mic. It's really easy to understand and siding with Flair. So, and to some degree they do, but you can watch these two get it back in the ring. It doesn't matter what they do outside. They always wind up in the right place where they want to be in the ring. They're so good at telling that story. So, so Steamboat takes a lot of the offense early, gets some nice moves in, head scissors, things like that. You know, some of the flashier moves, and I use that fairly loosely because Steamboat's thought of as, you know, kind of an aerial guy, and you know, there's a lot of the arm drags and things like that, but he doesn't do super fancy moves. Everything's pretty safe. It looks good, you know. And I like that. It seemed to me like there were a lot of one counts, so they're not all these dramatic near falls, and they have room to escalate from there. So, and I had Flair hits a crossbody with several exclamation points because I just was so surprised to see that. But it didn't matter because Steamboat reversed it for two. So even though Flair hit the crossbody, it was actually a Steamboat near fall. And Flair gets a figure four on, and the crowd's chanting for Steamboat now. So even though the angle might not have done Steamboat any favors, he gets the crowd right where he wants them. So, and Flair, you know, helping him all the time, cheating like crazy, of course. You know, these two do a great job selling the exhaustion, you know, so, you know, I love to see that. And Flair tries multiple pinfalls with his feet on the ropes, which, again, he does that all the time, but it plays in and it makes sense in this context too, because Ross notes that that's how he beat Luger at Starrcade, which was the last pay-per-view. So that was a good reminder. And I think there's just, the execution is just incredible on everything. And I bet on a pin where Flair barely got his foot on the ropes, even though I knew it wasn't the finish. And then right after that, you know, kind of in that amazing series that you're talking about, like, I cursed because Steamboat bumped the ref on a crossbody, and I was like, "God damn, here we go again on a BS finish." And I said that knowing full well, like, I've seen this match who knows how many times. I knew the finish. I knew that there wasn't a screwy finish, but everything was just so well executed that you get so in the moment, and they're just taking you along for the ride. So they just get you right where you want to be, rooting for the babyface there at the end. So it's an incredible, like, I'm sure a psychologist could do a study on this and you know, learn something or explain just how good they are at manipulating you. Although any psychologist that wants to delve into the minds of hardcore wrestling fans probably might want to rethink that. All right.
Yeah.
So let's see. So was that your number three?
That would be my number three. So we'll go to your number three.
My number three match is Sting Squadron versus the Dangerous Alliance War Games match from Wrestle War 1992. But we will not talk about that yet, Jake, because I believe you have that a little bit higher.
Yeah, it's getting to the point where we're kind of showing our hands at this point. You can kind of guess where it's going to go in just a second, because my number two match, which was your number nine match, Tyler, is Ric Flair versus Terry Funk from Great American Bash 89. So Swerve actually have Flair Funk higher than any of the Flair Steamboats, and have this match better than the I Quit match. So you're normally a stat guy, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but I don't know if you know offhand. So which one finished higher? Would it be this one or the I Quit match? Do you know?
This match finished seventh. The I Quit match finished eighth. But this match did, in fact, finish higher. And actually, it looks like it finished a fair bit higher on the points, but the I Quit was on all 24 ballots, and some bastard left off the Great American Bash match. I don't know who, but certainly was neither of us, because we both have it in our top 10.
Yeah, and we've discussed it, and it's not like I'm trying to, my point is that the people are wrong, but I guess it's just as somebody who is, you know, I wouldn't consider myself like a somebody who was super well versed in all these matches, or like hugely, you know, like a lot of this was me going into a lot of these matches, maybe for the first time, or I'd seen these matches in passing, but never really like watched them too intently kind of thing. And so to think, because to me, this one was just on another level from the I Quit match. I mean, like, I wouldn't put them in the same ballpark, really, which I feel like based on the list, a lot of people would. But it's not like to say I think people are wrong. It just kind of amazes me at somebody who's somewhat new to watching these that they're kind of considered in the same realm, because this was just on another level. Like, man, this match is so good. I love it. I love, like, Funk just brings this like insanity to the match where you just, and they say it, and it's sort of like the Funk thing, but like they say it on commentary, like you just never know what he's going to do next. But it's honestly like, it's not just what they're saying on commentary. He really does bring that into the match. Like, you really have no idea what he's going to do next. Like, early in the match, he's like taking a chair, throws it in the ring, and they have to throw the chair out. Like, he just brings this mania to the match that you can't take your eyes off of. And I think that's the biggest, like, almost like the best, like, broad positive I could say about this match is that when I watch it, like, I cannot look away no matter what. And I think even the best of those Steamboat Flair matches, like, especially like maybe the longer ones, like the hour long ones, it's like there's going to be times where maybe your attention may fade a little bit, where this match, like, I just cannot look away because I never know what's going to happen next. Like, you get all the great Funk stooging whenever Flair's on offense, like he's doing his normal Funk stuff. But then he zeroes in on Flair's neck, and he's just completely savage on the neck. Like, and I love that as a it works really well with him too, like I said, because he's such a maniac. And then it's a really awesome body part for him to pick, because, and they can sell it on commentary and you sort of believe it, because they keep saying, like, if he keeps going after the neck, he's liable to, like, permanently injure. Because I know Flair had the injured neck going in, I believe. And so they keep saying on commentary, like, if he goes after the neck, like, he could end Flair's career. He could permanently injure him. And because he's so crazy and it is the neck, you kind of believe it. Like, it's a hard thing to sell because it's so dramatic. But it's like he's just wild enough for you to believe it. So it's really awesome. Like, really awesome. Like, we've talked about a lot of these Flair heel performances, but he's a great face here as he's just trying to survive this, like, madman who's trying to just, like, snap his neck the entire match. When they go outside and they sell the drama of, like I said, it's so crazy. Like, you never know what's gonna happen. Like, Funk just goes outside, rips up the mat on the outside and tries to pile drive Flair on the cement, but Flair reverses it. And so it's just, he's just constantly trying to survive. And the finish goes right along with that, because it's like they do a reversal, like Funk gets the cradle and then Flair reverses it. You really don't see it coming at all. Like, it just seems like it's going to be okay. He gets pinned, he reverses it, get out of it. They go to the next spot. And then Flair is able to just keep it long enough to win. So it's a really surprising finish, but I think it's a really cool finish. And, man, it's just a crazy manic match that is just fantastic. And even the post-match is awesome, too. Like, just stuff you, like, Doug Dillinger gets beat up. Like, Doug Dillinger comes in because, you know, Funk's trying to main Flair. And so Doug Dillinger comes in to save it. And, like, Funk just mule kicks him in the thigh. And, like, how often do you get to see Doug Dillinger getting beat up? I don't know. I love it. Maybe you do.
Not often enough. Of this era,
but yes. Like, he just kicks Doug Dillinger. Like, you think that's going to mean, oh, Doug Dillinger's going to pull him off and that'll be it. But he just kicks him and keeps going. Muta comes in. And then the pop whenever Sting comes to save Flair is just – because first you get the Sting pop because the crowd's just yelling for Sting. He comes in. The crowd comes unglued. And he – and so by this point, you think Flair's out of the picture because they've been beating him down. And then as they're finally starting to get one up on Sting, Flair just comes flying into the frame and just awesome – you know, we talked about the plastic bag one, but just Funk has just the best. These post-match segments are just so good. He just is such chaos to him. I love it. I don't know. That's what I love about this match. It's fantastic. Just such awesome stuff. Funk is the man.
Yeah. And so I agree with you. Obviously, I was pretty notoriously low on the I Quit match. And I'll talk a little bit about it because I do think they do play off each other perhaps more than I'd given that credit. And I can see how, I think fans, especially if you were watching it live, and I really wasn't. I was watching it more as a rewatch or just over time. I'd seen both matches, you know, many times before this rewatch. But if you were watching it live, I could see how it all just works together as one long extended story. And in that case, the blow-off match being the I Quit probably gets quite a lot of notoriety. Also, I'd like to apologize to Doug Dillinger. I really have no beef with you. I'm sure you're a wonderful human being. So I'm sorry, Terry Funk kicked you in 1989. I think I said this match finished number 7 on the voter list. And I liked that before the match, Flair gives a really quiet and humble interview with Gordon Sully where he asked why he didn't have a warm-up match. And he says if he's 100%, he says in his mind and heart he is, but we'll know in about an hour. And it's a stark contrast from what you usually get out of Flair. So I like that. And Flair starts hot, brawling outside, just like someone who wants revenge for his opponent pile-driving on a table. I also noticed that there's a fan with a Sweet Poison t-shirt in the crowd, so 5 stars all the way on this. You talked about the intensity. It's just nuts, chops, and punches, all middle-aged and crazy shit from Funk. And I do think that Funk can be, like, all of his chaos can be, I think he kind of walks that line between complete insanity that really works and sometimes it looks a little hokey, and in this case, I think everything looked really dangerous, and sometimes, you know, if it doesn't hit, it can look a little silly, but that wasn't the case here. So there's one point where Flair tries to suplex the outside, and Funk kind of winds up falling on him like a crossbody, and they both just kind of tumble outside, and, like, that could have been a botch, or it might have been on purpose. I really don't know. It just fits perfectly because it's that kind of match, and everything in this match shouldn't be smooth because it's just that chaos that you talked about. And you're right, the psychology with the Nick and the pile drivers is just something they can just keep going back to. So, you know, you mentioned Funk bringing up the mat, and then Flair goes for the Flair reverses to the backdrop, and, you know, Flair hitting a couple pile drivers of his own. At one point, Flair tried to punch, and that kind of sucked, so he goes back to the chops and forearms, and he gets the figure four. But Funk gets the branding iron from Hart and waffles Flair, who he's bleeding now. Funk actually winds up hitting a pile driver, and that's where the announcers are worried about Flair's neck, and like you say, like he might be done, but he gets his foot on the ropes. And then Flair's pulling up the mat. He's choking Flair with tape, trying the pile driver. Flair counters to a backdrop. Flair is a bloody mess here, and he's selling the neck, and he does. oh God, and you know, Flair's working, or Funk's working the Nikki's, oh God, and Funk wants Flair to say I quit, as Hart's begging him to take the pin, and that was something I didn't notice as much in earlier viewings, but obviously that's laying the foundation for that I quit match. And this was at a time where Funk was pretty well in control, and it did look like he at least, it would be plausible that he might have been able to get a pin, but he wanted to make him quit. Excuse me. And Flair gets a branding iron, and he nails Funk, and now Funk's bleeding all over the place too. And Funk goes to the spinning toe hold, which you know that he and his brother were famous for. And Flair tries to counter to a figure four, but then Funk gets a cradle. But then Flair reverses that cradle to an inside cradle for the win. And then you mentioned the beatdown afterwards. It's great. Muda comes out, miss Flair. They double team, and the crowds, they try for a pile driver on the chair. And there's where, you know, my new best friend, Doug Dillinger, stops it being the gentleman and scholar that he is. The crowd's chanting for Sting, and he makes the save. And honestly, if the brawl afterwards was its own match, that might have made the bottom part of my list, because it's just, goes on forever. There's about four different stops and starts, and they're doing the interviews, and then, you know, Ross and Cottle doing the interviews, I think, and they're, you know, they're waiting to get the Flair or Sting, and then they just are going nuts. And I didn't make notes on it, but I remember the interview afterwards being really good. Flair there with his, you know, his hair is just red from the blood, and he said, you know, I've never said thank you in 10 years or whatever, but thank you, Sting, and, you know, kind of putting Sting over, cementing. I mean, Flair was already a babyface, but just really getting that over. And, he threatens Funk and Muda, and, you know, it's nice to see them together, and then they kind of go off for a bit, and it's almost like they forgot, oh, Sting was actually supposed to say something. So he comes back in and just does like a, ooh, yeah, or his little crow call or whatever. It's like, Flair nailed everything. Oh, shit, we forgot Sting didn't say a word, which would have been perfectly fine with what Sting's contributions wound up being. Total package was just, and not like Luger, the total package, but the complete set of match and post-match was just fantastic.
Yeah, it's so good. But all I can see is that when Flair comes back in the frame, and then when you think he's like knocked out, it's just, oh, it's perfection. But anyway, all right, Todd, let's go to your number two. Yes, number two.
Oh, yeah. My number two is Magnum TA versus Tully Blanchard, I Quit Steel Cage Match for the U.S. title.
Oh, Sean Kidd just woke up in a cold sweat in the best way.
Yeah, well, I got to tell you, I have a little guilt that it's number two and not number one. But, you know, you just have to, something has to be number one and something has to be the bridesmaid. So this was match number three on the total voter composite list. And Magnum and Tully had a great feud going into Starrcade 85, as was well documented on Croc and Roll, a fantastic podcast that you have been a guest on. And as you mentioned, Sean Kidd hosts that with, it's Callum's on there. This is co-host, right? And Dr. G, is that right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, good. Well, I've enjoyed it, but it's been a while, and you know, my memory isn't always the best, but this match is the best, or one of the best, as, you know, the vastly popular Magnum, as he's announced, is just glaring cold fire at Tully before the match, and they start slow. I mean, they don't like rush right at each other, but angry and cautious. Like they're making everything like a struggle. Although I'd say they started a little slow. Magnum's bleeding like 2 minutes in, and the announcers are doing a tremendous job of selling the humiliation of having to grab the mic and say, I quit. And every move just feels gritty. And when I say moves, that's, I'm using that term fairly loosely, is they're not, these aren't a lot of wrestling moves. Like there's no, you know, Irish whip, drop down, you know, go to, you know, arm drag, none of that. So this feels like two people that hate each other are fighting. So they're all punches, slams, throwing each other into the cage, maybe some hammer locks, but 5 minutes in, they are just slugging each other and yelling at each other to quit, screaming, no. It's a very verbal match, and this works because it's not like there's a long speech. They're not explaining things to each other. It's just guttural grunting and yelling because they're so mad and they're so determined. Tully's arm is a bloody mess, and Magnum is too, and it's hard to tell where the blood's coming from. Just over 5 minutes in, Tully does a chop off the top rope and gets the mic, and there's more yelling and just hitting Magnum with the mic. And it's hard to do this justice just talking about it, but you've got to see it, and you especially hear it. Both guys are just selling the exhaustion from war and blood loss, and it's really, this is a fairly short match overall, but really early in, they get that over. Magnum's in control, and Tully's just screaming, no, into the mic, and just continuous grunting and bleeding and struggling all the way. And they have these punch exchanges, but they're from their knees. They're like, they can't even stand up, but they're still so mad and they're fighting each other. And I'm shadow boxing, which doesn't play very well in podcast form, but it's just fantastic. And just thinking about it gets me back into it. And Tully just keeps getting more frustrated as Magnum refuses to say, I quit, when Tully pounds on him with the mic and elbows and punches. And he eventually just tosses the ref. So Baby Doll, who was Tully's second, like his valet, throws in this wooden chair, and Tully begins to smash it, and he makes this spike out of the chair, you know, which he just smashed right there in the ring. So I have no idea if that was a gimmick. I don't know if they practiced it. I don't know if Tully just made that a hobby to smash chairs to make this spike. This famous finish comes when Tully's trying to force the spike into Magnum's face. The announcers say forehead, but I always think that he was trying to shove this spike into his eye. Magnum catches his arm, and he blocks it, and the spike's just inches from his face, and they're struggling for control, and it just feels like the difference between a severe injury and survival. It's like, it looks like in a movie, like if a serial killer had a knife, and they're just trying to stab you, and you block it, and you're just holding on for all your worth. You know, Magnum's arms are shaking. He eventually is able to power out and overpower Tully. He knocks him down, and the spike goes flying, and Magnum gets the spike. And he puts the spike in Tully's forehead, and he's just bleeding a river. And they have a great shot. Magnum's standing above him. He's got the spike into his forehead as Tully's screaming, and he's bleeding. And I'm showing you all this again. It's hard to put into words for audio. He's got the spike in Tully's forehead, bleeding a river, famous shot, and Tully screams, yes, yes, yes. And no one has the mic, so he has to scream loud enough, the mic to pick it up, and he does. Technically, he never actually says, I quit, but he, you know, screaming yes, Magnum's the winner. And Magnum gives this look, and he thinks about hitting Tully or using the spike again. But he just kind of holds Tully's head and gives him this look of disgust and disdain for the heel, and then just kind of drops him. And Tully just looks pathetic, and you almost sympathize with this, you know, slimy shit heel that's been a bastard forever. And it's hard to describe and get across the brutality, the hatred that came across, and the humiliation that the loser suffered. I mean, it's just an epic battle that says so much in like 15 minutes. And again, the wrestlers just get across the humiliation that would come, you know, from being forced to say, I quit, to the point where you're feeling bad for Tully. And just, I mean, I love it so much. I love the story they were able to tell, and, you know, their facial expressions and just what they were able to convey in this is just is just amazing.
Yeah, it's just such a gritty war. Like, it's so, I feel like this is a match if you were trying to convince somebody, like, I don't know if it would work, but if you were trying to convince somebody, like, wrestling was real, like, this could be a match you would probably try and show them. Because it's just, like, everything they do, it's so, like, there's so many points in the match where they're just, like, falling on top of each other, and they're, like, kind of trying to punch each other, but they can't really. Like, there's that point where they both just grab each other by the hair because they don't really have the strength or anything or the position to punch each other. So just, like, grabbing and pulling each other's hair. It's just so, like, it's like that that fight from the movie They Live or whatever, where it's just kind of, like, sloppy and, like, it's to the point where neither one of them have anything left. And like you said, the wood spot is just brutal. Like, he's just, man, and it's so, like, it's just like a jagged piece of wood that he's just got in his forehead. And the camera work is so good in this match. They really get in there close. The shots where they cut to Baby Doll are so good, where she's just, like, in shock. It's just, the one thing that is weird about the presentation of this whole match is I find the commentary is, like, weirdly clinical for this, rewatching it. And it doesn't really hurt the match, because the match, it's like a match that doesn't even honestly need commentary, really, to get its point across. But it is sort of weird. Like, I mean, I guess it's, like, still pretty young Tony, where he's still sort of in, like, generic sports announcer mode a little bit. But I could see him doing this a lot better later in his career, because it's like these guys are killing each other. And at one point he just goes like, wow, this is really turning into an all out brawl. It's like they're murdering each other. It's just right. It's a little like, you know, there's so many times in wrestling where we see the commentary, it's like over the top. But this, it felt like weirdly subdued for what was happening. Like, these two guys look like they're literally about to kill each other, like, in the ring, and they're just like, wow, this is pretty crazy. So, just a weird thing I noted. It is a strange part of this match, but it doesn't affect it anyway. Yeah, it's a classic. It's just, you know, we said throughout this whole thing, like, we've had all these good, brutal matches, and I think this is the one here, you know? Like, this is the top one. I mean, this kind of sets the standard of, like, these brutal grudge matches, because, and there really is so much heat to them. Like, I know it's not really something we factored in a ton in this, but the feud, like you said, Sean's cover on Croc and Roll, the feud leading up to it is so good. It's so much of Tully just trying to run down Magnum and say he's better than him and all this. And it built for so long that it's just a great blow off. And, you know, it could be a reason why I'm lower on the Funk I Quit match, because it's hard to not think of this one when you think of an I Quit match.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And there's just no I Quit match that's going to touch this one. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. So we're there. We have reached the peak of the mountain. All right. So my number one, which it's probably known by now, is going to be the War Games match from WrestleWar 92, Sting Squadron versus the Dangerous Alliance. You know, my favorite War Games, I think a lot of people's favorite War Games. I love the presentation. This is, of course, the famous where when they have the fireworks when the cage is coming down, which I love so much. Like, the cage has its own music. It has fireworks. Like, it's a star just as much as anybody else, because by this point, it's been established through all these other great ones. Like, we talked about the original. We talked about the one in 91. Like, the reputation of War Games is fully established. Like, everybody knows what they're in for with it, which is really awesome. And I also thought, just as like a full list thing, I did think it was fitting to have a War Games match as, you know, on a WCW greatest match list, as the number one, because it is such a big part of, you know, arguably the most beloved thing to come out of WCW is the War Games. If you think about it, like, it's just such a beloved match style that they brought it back eventually in NXT and all that. But it's just some, like, one of these, like, universally loved things, which is very hard to find in wrestling, I find. But anyway, just, I love the huddle, and it maybe has the, I think maybe the best kind of, the two sides and, you know, the huddle. Like, yeah, you have Heyman with the, he has like the board, like he's, fucking, you know, like drawing up a play, like he's, you know, like he's coaching the NBA or something. Like, it's just amazing. Like, out of that, like, every entrant when they come into this match, it just feels like a big deal. I think they, I think maybe it doesn't have the chaos of the original one. Like, it never gets to that level. But I do think the action in the ring is a little bit better. Like, just the guys, I think maybe because, like we talked about with that that early one, it does have all those power guys, and it's good for when they come in. But I think you have better all-around wrestlers in this one who can kind of do a little bit more dynamic stuff in this, and I think it helps this one a bit. And I think another thing that helps in this one is you have so many little sub-feuds going on within the match, because you have the bigger thing of the Dangerous Alliance as like the stable and everything, but then you have these little mini feuds, like you have Rude and Steamboat who are feuding with each other. You know, you have all these little subplots going on within the match, which is always an awesome thing. It's you know, it's some people talk about with the Royal Rumble of the best Rumbles have that sort of thing, and I think this has that going on too, where you have all these little sub feuds. Great chaos as usual. It has the, of course, Arn getting his head stuck in between the two rings, which is always great. You get Medusa going on top of the cage, which I thought Medusa and Heyman were great in this, because there were enough of, like, you felt their presence, but it never overshadowed. Like, Medusa does the one spot. You get Ducey on the cage, and Sting chases her off, which the crowd eats up. And she throws the phone in there, which allows the heels to get the upper hand. Just sweat and blood. Like, the entire ring is just caked in sweat and blood, and it's just insanity. And to top it all off, you get the whole finish of the matches. Like I said, you get the shot that you get in all these war games, and maybe this is the best it's ever looked, is when they just cut and you just see all these guys and there's just blood everywhere. And I love the way that with the ring post, because that's what plays into the finish, the I don't know what you call, like, the ring support, like the fucking screw, like the bar that sticks the turnbuckle into the ring post, is like, so you kind of see them, like, they mess with it, and they kind of point on commentary, it looks like the ropes are starting to droop, it looks like, the you know, somebody undid it a little bit, and then finally it just completely comes off, and Bobby Eaton grabs it, and he gives it to I'm trying to think, who does he give? Oh, it's Larry, because that's what ends up getting them pissed at Larry at the end. And so Larry goes to hit, oh, I can't remember, there's so much shit going on, I can't remember who he's trying to hit. I want to say he goes to hit Sting, maybe. I don't really remember.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, it's Sting. Sting puts the arm bar on him. So he goes to hit Sting, and then he accidentally hits Bobby Eaton, who sells it like he just got his shoulder. But it looks insane, because it's basically just like a 18-inch like steel rod. And he goes to hit him, but he hits Bobby, and then Sting puts him in the arm bar, and he has to surrender. But it's so good, because you legit think, like, they sell it like crazy. Like, you could think that he probably, like, you know, broke Bobby Eaton's shoulder, so he kind of has to give up. So I like the finish. It's just fantastic. You have so many great workers in there. You do have the power guys, too, because you do have Nikita in there, but you have Austin in there, you have Dustin, you have Barry, you have all these guys who can really go. And I think maybe that's the advantage it has over the original, is that you just have better all-around, more dynamic workers in the match. So you get all that violence and stuff, but I feel like the actual action in the ring is just a little bit more interesting to watch at times. But, man, it's just I could watch this match over and over again. It's not super long for how epic it feels. It's really only about 30 minutes. It doesn't go that much longer after they get to the match beyond. I don't know. I love this match so much. Obviously, that's why it was number one. It's just great. It's so good. I feel like it encapsulates so many of the great things of WCW, and that's why I thought it was very fitting to have it as number one.
Yep, I absolutely agree with everything you said. I can watch this match over and over. I have watched this match over and over. I have long considered this one of my Desert Island matches. If I'm ever stranded on a desert island that has a DVD player, but no other electricity, so I can't get rescued, this is one of the matches I want there. You know, give me 5 or 10, this would probably make it. This match finished number 4 on the voter list. I had it match 3, you had it match 1, of course. It's the highest ranking War Games on both of our lists and on the consensus list, and it's, you know, I think it's fair to say it's generally considered the best War Games by most. You know, I thought Barry and Austin, they had a great opening sequence, constant action. Austin hits a clothesline from one ring to the next. Barry swings Austin up to the top of the cage and then just kind of drops him. And Austin goes into the cage and he's bleeding, and that first segment. Pauly keeps talking about strategy like it was a real sport and it's picked up by the mic and a nice touch. So, but I like that because it did seem like he was coaching them, like you mentioned, drawing up plays, whatever. And he would always say, this is what we're going to do. And it was like he wasn't speaking into a mic, so he would just get caught by the mic every once in a while. The Dangerous Alliance wins the toss, Rude's in. And then once Austin picks up his bloody carcass, then they take over. The Dangerous Alliance takes over with the numbers game. But it did take a while because Austin's bleeding pretty good, and he took a pretty good kick in there. Steamboat's in next, runs wild, hits DDTs. And, you know, I'm making another note that Austin's just got a gross crimson mask right from the beginning. He tries a somersault into a shoulder block, but Steamboat grabs the top of the cage to dodge. And, you know, he kicks Austin away, grabs the roof, get on Rude's shoulders, and hit a Rana. And this is where, you know, I'd echo what you said, that there are so many good workers here. There's just so many moves and action, and that's what sets them apart from the other war games that have a lot of intensity, but it's a lot of punches and slamming into the cage. And this has all that, but they work in a lot of good work as well. With like Arn's next in, and he DDTs Wyndham, then hits a spine buster on Steamboat. So like you're seeing those moves that you'd love to see. He and Rude do a double Boston crab on Steamboat, which I thought was really nice. Rude hits a pile driver on Steamboat. Dustin's in, and he has a nice exchange with Arn, calling back to his dad, and Arn being the first in the war games. So I don't know if that was an actual callback, but I watched these on the same night reviewing for this podcast, so I thought it kind of was. Like you mentioned, Arn got his head stuck between the rings, and Wyndham's kind of pile driving him a few times, holding him by the legs and slamming him in between the rings, which looked nice. Larry's in next, and Dustin goes right at him. And this is where Medusa climbed the cage, like drop the phone into the ring, like you mentioned. And Sting joins her on up top. Is the roof of this cage is starting to sag quite a bit. And I think both Medusa and Sting are kind of like, fuck this shit, I'm out of here. It looked kind of odd because Sting climbs up to the top and then just like yells at her and they both get down. So I assume they might have thought, you know what, this may not be the best idea we've ever had. Get the hell out of here. We've proven our point. We got the phone in. Let's go. And Arn does wind up hitting Steamboat with the phone. And Rude's working over Steamboat's nose, which I thought was really kind of an interesting thing to work. You know, the Dangerous Alliance had previously injured his nose. So Rude's working that. Now Dustin's bleeding. And then Sting's in and he runs wild. He military presses Rude into the roof of the cage. That drops somebody into the cage and just going nuts, and so is Ross, and so is the crowd. Barry's bleeding a lot as Eaton enters, and Eaton entering has Pauly, he's just going nuts, he's chanting war, 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 which I thought was nice to see Pauly just losing his mind. There's blood all over the ring, like you mentioned. It looks, you know, looks like a horror movie. Larry's loosening the turnbuckle so the ropes are loose. The crowd's chanting for Nikita. So he enters and he helps Sting, and then they're kind of glaring at each other, and he saves him from a sneak attack, and then they clean house and they high five and they hug, and the crowd goes nuts for that because they'd had their issues. They feuded over the US title in 91. So there was some question over whether Sting Squadron could trust Nikita, and there he showed that indeed they could. Arn's also a bloody mess now. There's so much blood. It looks like a horror movie because everyone that's bleeding is just really bleeding and all over the ring, like you mentioned. The Dangerous Alliance gets that steel rod from the turnbuckle. And I would have helped you out there, Jake, if I hadn't had any idea what to call it. But I think we all know what it is, you know. So, and it's still attached to the ropes. Like they got it loose, but they're still attached to the ropes. It just looks. It adds to the chaotic feel, I think. And you know, and Larry kind of takes it from Bobby. I think he kind of hands it to Larry. His body language is kind of, here, let me do this. I'll take care of it. And I wondered if maybe Bobby is the only one that knew how to put the ring together and take it apart, and that's why it took so long to get it up. I don't know. Bobby seems like a guy that'd be pretty handy. So he tries to hold Sting. Of course, Larry screws up and hits Bobby with the steel. And then Larry puts Eaton, or Sting hits a flurry on Larry and then puts Eaton in the armbar. And Steamboat cuts off Larry, so Eaton had to submit. Like you said, he felt like he got shot. I love that it was an armbar that was the finish to this violent a match. And I love that that starts the storyline that Larry fucked up and he's the weakest link in the Dangerous Alliance. And, you know, I had just got this match maybe perfect. And I had it number 3, but I feel like it was always one of a very short list for a number one contender. You know, I just said that I felt somewhat guilty having Cully Magnum 2. I really had 3 matches that when I started this, I thought could be number one. This match, Magnum Tully, and the next match that I'll talk about that did wind up finishing as my number one.
Yeah. So bring us home. What's your number one?
Oh, all right. So I think by now anyone listening has probably figured out that my number one is one match we have noticeably not talked about as Ric Flair versus Ricky Steamboat. 2 out of 3 falls for the NWA World title at Clash of the Champions 6. So this match finished as the overall number one. So once again, I matched the voters, although this was probably the chalk, the cannon pick all along. So maybe I showed a lack of creativity there. So I guess I'll just live with that, but I can live with that. Steamboat starts fast, arm drags and headlocks. They have these bursts of really fast action, scissors, chops, etc. And then Steamboat will go to the headlock, and he's getting pin attempts off of it, so it doesn't come off like it's a rest hold or anything. Funk's on commentary, and he says that they might get a quick fall at this pace. That it does not turn out to be the case. These pin attempts off the headlock, they're kind of a staple that Flair Steamboat matches. And we've seen that throughout this being this list, and you almost never see it elsewhere. So I kind of like that. Ross and Funk make note of the physicality and thought that it might get that way in the second fall, but not so early. And dadgummit, Jim, you know, that's what Funk has to offer to that as they're getting into this violence. Steamboat misses a drop kick. Flair tries for the figure 4, which Steamboat reverses to an inside cradle that Flair then turns over to win the first fall in 1935. And Funk notes that there's no pacing these guys are going so fast. They're not pacing themselves, is what he means by that. Steamboat was so frustrated at the break, and he starts fast and aggressive with a top rope chop trying to even it up. Flair misses a knee drop, and Steamboat drops 15 elbows on the leg before putting on a figure 4 on Flair, who makes the ropes and gives it, oh God, as only Flair can do. Steamboat tries again, but Flair kicks him off, and Steamboat goes for a Boston Crab. But Flair makes the ropes again, and another more dramatic, oh God. So that Flair's escalating his oh Gods here. Steamboat's outside, and Funk says if he's counted out, it's a new champ. Although the Hollywood Blondes Horseman match that we talked about earlier would seem to indicate otherwise, fortunately that's not an issue here. We don't have to go to any screwy finish like that, or at least not that screwy finish. Flair is controlling in the second fall until the crowd chants Steamboat's name, and Flair goes up top and comes down with a superflex, works the back. And then he gets the double chicken wing, and Flair submits, which is huge to win the second fall. And I don't believe Flair had ever submitted. And then the announcers made a big deal to say that he had never submitted. And I believe that to be the case, or at least I certainly couldn't prove them wrong. So that was a big deal, and they made it a big deal. So we're 35 minutes in, and we're tied 1-1, and player's trying to work for the figure four, and then he goes for this series of pins with his foot on the ropes, numerous chop battles just kind of sprinkled in. That's something they always kind of go back to, and they just, you know, chop the piss out of each other all the time. I mean, we all of us that have watched those matches know that. Flair hits the figure four for several near falls. Steamboat, and during this figure four, Steamboat like rocks back and forth until eventually they roll over to the ropes, but it's not like he doesn't just roll over it. Like, he has to rock kind of like a boat will do in the water until he can finally get momentum to roll all the way over. So, and again, I'm moving my hands to help illustrate the point. So I'm not sure if that's coming across perfectly. Flair continues working the leg, slamming it on the apron. Steamboat's selling the leg and hitting chops as the announcer starts saying that champ has the advantage of time. Flair does a crossbody for a hot near fall. And then Steamboat's leg gives way as he tries a body slam as we get 45 minutes. Steamboat hits a crossbody for two, and Flair gets a sleeper, and it's logical that that would work. But Steamboat gets his arm up on the third try, and it was like they really sold that could be the finish. The ref was walking toward the timekeeper to tell him to ring the bell, according to the announcers. So Flair kicks Steamboat's leg and then looks for a figure four, but Steamboat counters with an enziguri. Funk says this is the best match he's ever seen, and it has to be the match of the year, unless it's the Chi-Town Rumble. I agree that this is the match of the year. I'm ahead of the number one WCW match of all time, but being the match of the year in this particular year is really something. And in fact, match of the year, that is something that Funk has something to say, may have something to say about that later. They have this epic chop battle as they're just gassed and they're still fighting for all they're worth. Steamboat's aggressive, trying not to stall. He's not trying to run out the clock at all. He's being really aggressive. And the finish comes as Steamboat goes to the double chicken wing again, Flair falls back, and it looks like a double pin. And Flair has his foot on the ropes, but the ref says that Steamboat had Flair's shoulders down. And that's at 56 minutes. So they kind of made you think they were going for the draw, but then they pay it off with a finish. And it was a little bit of a screwy finish, but I'm fine with that, as that means they need a rematch at WrestleWar. And I think it's really hard to do justice to this match just talking about it, because it's just perfect execution for this one for nearly an hour. They make you think it might be a draw. They don't do that. They have really fast pace, particularly for a match that goes this long. There's tons of action, storytelling with layers for such a long match. It just never feels like it's long. And that's something that I think is very much to their credit. And you'll hear, I've always heard people say that about it. And I felt like it really hit home to me during this project where you're watching it. And it was hard for me to believe this match really was that long. So that's why, just that kind of perfect execution, and that's the reasons why that one wound up as number one.
Oh, well said. I don't know. I don't think I get anything to tell you. I had a number four. Yeah, it's incredible stuff. The selling particularly is just next level. Man, that's it. We got through all of it. I can't believe it. It's kind of a disbelief. Real quick, we have a few. I think we're going a little long, but that's okay. It's the last one. If you want, since you probably need a breather, I could run through. We have a few just quick kind of stat categories comparing our list to the composite list, and just a few little we'll call it stat-based little tidbits here. So the lowest ranking of a match on each of our lists. So the lowest ranking of a match that was on our list that made the top one, the lowest rank according to the voters that made our list. So for you, Tyler, it was Cactus versus Vader from April 24th, 93, which finished number 280 on the voter list, and you had it number 92. So that's a differential of 188 spots, but not to be outdone. Mine was Sting versus Goldberg from September 98. That was number 299 on the voter list, so pretty near the bottom there. I had it number 96, so that was 203 spots different from the voter, so quite a gap there. Just cut in if you'd like to comment on any of these, Tyler, as I run through. The match with the largest gap over the voter list, yeah, we were higher than the voters. That's the same as what I just said. Yeah. Same thing. It would be Cactus Invader and Sting Goldberg. The highest ranking for a match that did not make the list. The highest ranked match that you had, Tyler, that did not make the top 100 of the voter list would have been the Hollywood Blondes versus Dos Hombres from Slamboree 93. You had it ranked number 60. It did not make the list. It finished at number 115. So 55 spots away. For me, that would have been Jack Briscoe versus Roddy Piper from July of 82, which I had ranked number 19 and it finished number 18. Shame, shame, voters, that should have been on the top 100. I'll stand by that one. Next up, we have the largest gap under the voter list, that matches that we both rated that were lower than the... that we had lower than the voter list. So, like, the biggest differential compared to the voter. So, for you, Tyler, it would have been Flair and Funk, the I Quit match, which finished number 8 on the voter list. You had it ranked number 87. So, you stuck it right up the butt with that one. Mine would have been Sting versus Cactus Jack, the Falls County War from Beach Blast. It finished number 36, and I had it at number 97. So... we went away from consensus on those, Tyler. The match that finished highest that did not appear on our list. So for you, Tyler, it would have been Sting versus Flair from Bash 90, which finished number 44. That did not make your list. And for me, it would have been Ric Flair versus Ricky Morton from Great American Bash 1986. That was 26 on the voter list that did not make mine. All right, so now these we're going to kind of call as we go. So a match that you voted for, that a match that we voted for, yeah, that we might not include if we would redo our list. So, what would you?
So I have one. Like? I have one more that, and I may have added this after I had messaged you. So apologies if I'm taking you by surprise. But this is the match that you are higher than the other person on. So the biggest gap between our list. So I had the Fantastics versus the Sheepherders from Crockett Cup '86. I had that at 23, and you had that at 93, so that's a difference of 70. You had Ric Flair versus Hulk Hogan, Bash at the Beach, 94. You had that at 25, and I had that at 95, so that's a difference of 70. So that's where we were at on the match where we were higher than each other for.
That we both ranked. Gotcha.
Yes. So, yeah, I didn't think it was fair to go on matches that we didn't rank, because I didn't really go, once it was past 100, I didn't spend a lot of time ranking them, whether they were 101 or 110 or whatever.
Yeah, same. And for those, it could have been like, I know when it was Morton and Flair, for me, that one just kind of slipped through the cracks where I didn't even watch it. Where if we both ranked it, you can assure that it's, we both watched it. It's just a matter of where we put it. So I get it.
Right.
You have a match that you maybe not include on your list, or do you have any more before we get to that? Nope. Any other categories?
Nope. We are ready for the match you voted for that you might not include on your list. And I can go first, and the one that I had that I might not include if I were doing this again now would be Steve Austin versus Barry Windham from WCW Saturday Night 5992. And I do think that was a good match, but it probably was maybe a step lower than most of the other ones on the, that would make the list.
Yeah. I think for me, even though I didn't have it ranked super or anything, I'd probably take the Goldberg Sting match off, as the voters would probably agree. I think I maybe when I watched that one, it maybe got me, because up to that point, it's probably the best. I think part of me wanted to put Goldberg on because I felt he should be represented on the list because he is such a big part, even if he didn't have the greatest matches. But looking back, I think there's only two Goldberg matches in WCW that are in the realm that should be making the list. And that's the DDP match, because that's a legitimately good match. And the Hogan match, just for the moment. But the Sting one, that sharpshooter is trash in MS. But anyway, match that you didn't include but wish you had. I can do this one first if you want. So I think I have two here, and it's for different reasons. So that Enforcers match, just because it's an awesome match, and I love the Enforcers. We talked about it when we did it. And also, I actually didn't include the Bash at the Beach 96, the tag match with the Hogan turn and all that, which I think for the significance, I was stuck between those two. The Hogan one, the tag at Bash at the Beach for the moment, and then Enforcers one for the match quality. But those are kind of my two picks.
Okay. My choice was Rey Mysterio versus Dean Malenko from Great American Bash 96. And we talked about it a little bit when we got to it. I felt like their Halloween Havoc match, I liked it a little bit better. That said, I should have made room on the list for both of them. And the fact that it was Rey's debut, I think, was perhaps more significant than I gave it a credit for.
Gotcha. All right, next one, unexpected find that made your list, which is probably one of the best parts of doing these projects. So what would you say was your unexpected find of this project, Tyler?
Yeah, so I cheated on this one a little bit. I gave an honorable mention of Barry Windham versus Arn Anderson from WCW Saturday Night, 6-6-92. And this match, it was a 2 out of 3 falls on Saturday Night. And so I think seeing this one and how great it was, kind of is what made me think maybe the Austin Windham one was a step behind that. So that was my honorable mention. The one that I had to go with then was Tully Blanchard versus Ron Garvin from Worldwide, 5-3-86. And that may be in part because I almost missed it. It was very close to the end of the voting, and I realized that I'd missed one in my TV watching, went back and watched it, and it won me over just immediately. I thought it was awesome and held up when I rewatched it when we were covering it on the podcast. So that's my unexpected find.
Yeah, I spoke about mine whenever we were doing the list, but it definitely, I think the Piper stuff in general, but I kind of knew a few of them. Like, I was at least familiar with the Piper Valentine feud, but if I were to pick one match, definitely that Piper Briscoe match, which ended up was nowhere on my radar when I started the project and ended up making my top 20. So that was a really awesome find. And then our last category would be favorite match from the other person's list that you did not have. So, Tyler, what wonderful match from my list would you have taken?
The wonderful match from your list. And I should note, you had Rey and Dean from Great American Bash 96, but I didn't choose that one. So that can be another one of the wonderful matches you had. But I chose the Dick Slater and Great Muta versus Ric Flair and Sting from Clash of the Champions 8, I think. So yeah, I missed that one somehow. Kind of was asleep the wheel on that one. So I was glad that I got to rewatch it covering this podcast because you had the good sense to select it, Jake.
Well, thank you. I think I'm gonna go with that Enforcers match that I talked about earlier. Big whiff, because I really do love that. I love the Enforcers and I love that match so much with the Steamboat coming back and all. It's just fantastic. And I think if there were another, oh man, I just had one in my head that you had that it was a, didn't I miss one of the Regal matches? I not have Regal Arn?
Oh. Regal Arn, yeah.
So I'd probably pick that one too. So I'll double dip and pick those two.
Okay. This was not meant as an exercise in self-loathing though. So we don't want you to beat yourself. No self-flagellation or anything. Although there'll be no judging, you know.
Yeah.
I guess don't let me tell you what to do.
It's only a fitting way to go out doing this. It's one last self-deprecating, you know, having pity on myself for screwing up. But anyway, do we have any more? That's all the categories I had. Did you have any more you wanted to talk about, Tyler, before we wrap it up and put a bow on this beautiful project?
I did not have any other categories. I'd just like to say thank you, Jake, for agreeing to do this when I reached out and for recording and handling all the editing and technical things of that nature and guiding me along and podcast journey and thanks to all the listeners. I've had a blast. I've really enjoyed this. This is a good way to extend the project that I enjoyed so much from last year. And and is kind of a primer for the one that's going on this year, the greatest WCW wrestler ever. So if you haven't checked that out on our Facebook page, please do so. Engage in the conversation so you can vote in our project for 2021.
Absolutely. And I'm going to put you over one last time for this, Tyler, but Tyler does so much work behind the scenes, putting all these projects together, putting all the stuff up on the Facebook page and to help people research, compiling the votes, doing the write-ups, just countless stuff. So it was awesome to have you have a chance to actually do the to come in and talk about the actual matches, because you do so much legwork with the project. I'm glad you got a chance to come and actually talk about, you know, like what you pick for the list, because you do so much behind the scenes work. So and like Tyler said, make sure you check out the new project that is usually this is about the time of year I feel like where it really starts humming, is about summertime, as people really start digging into it and trying to come up with it going into the fall and the winter where you have to submit the list. I usually feel like it can be a little bit kind of slow starting early in the year because people are finishing up the last project, getting warmed up for this one. But I think it'll probably start kicking up pretty good as we're about halfway through the year.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it. So, and I'm wondering, I think Tim Capel's going to get his ballot in here any day now. So look forward to seeing that as well.
And when that happens, we'll come in and retabulate everything. And just kidding, no one's doing that. Sorry, Tim.
Love you, Tim. We're not doing that, though.
But this has been a ton of fun, Tyler. I'm glad you had the idea. I'm glad you reached out to me to do this. It was really fun to go back through and rewatch all these matches and talk about them and stuff. It's been a great time. I don't know. I'll let you close it out, Tyler. Anything you want to leave them with as we wrap it up?
I think we covered it well. I enjoyed going through the matches again. I enjoyed talking them over with you, Jake. I enjoyed hearing your perspectives and sharing them with any listeners we may have. So just thanks, everybody, and we'll catch you next time. You're like a dream come true. Just want to be with you. It's plain to see that you're the only one for me. And four, repeat steps 1 through 3. I make you fall in love with me. If ever I believe my work is done, then I'll start back at 1. Yeah, yeah. Work themselves out, and all emotional once you know what.